It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis is here. Kevin Marks is here. We've got a lot to talk about. Of course, we'll mention the story out of Irving, Texas, about Ahmed and his time bomb clock. But there's also great news from Google, some acquisitions, some hires, and the return of Google Glass. Maybe. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 318, recorded Wednesday, September 16th, 2015. Welcome to the Paw Paw Festival. This Week in Google is brought to you by Samsung SmartThings. Samsung SmartThings lets you monitor, control, and secure your home from wherever you are using your smartphone. Right now, This Week in Google listeners get 10% off any featured SmartThings kit and free shipping in the U.S. when you go to smartthings.com/twig and use the offer code TWIG at checkout. And by LegalZoom. If you're looking to incorporate, form an LLC, get a trademark, or more, LegalZoom can help you get started the right way. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but it can connect you with an independent attorney. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TWIG in the referral box at checkout for your special discount. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we talk about the Googleverse, the Twitterverse, the Facebookverse, and there's a lot of versing going on right now. We also do a lot of media coverage because of this guy right here, one of the world's most renowned, most prestigious media pundits.
Professor, I'm trying to look as renowned and prestigious as I can.
You don't look prestigious. You look crazy. Jeff Jarvis, he's a professor of journalism at the City University of New York, the author of What Would Google Do?, Public Parts, Gutenberg the Geek, Geeks Bearing Gifts, and blogs at BuzzMachine.com. Hello, Mr. J.
Good to be back on the show. How was New York for you?
I love New York. I mean, I don't know how anybody has a car in New York.
No.
It takes, even with Uber or taxis, it takes forever to get anywhere. We ended up on the subway.
Subways.
We did. Yeah, we ended up on the subway because it's the only way to get around town.
It's the best way. It's a 600-mile miracle.
It is, really.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
It is. I had to persuade Lisa to go on the subway.
No. It's the only way to go.
Yeah, but once we did, she said, why haven't we been taking these this time? It's like,
Well, the frustration of sitting in traffic is just awful. No, I never drive into the city. I drive to the river.
Yeah.
And take the train underneath.
Also here, Kevin Marks.
Hi there, gentlemen.
From KevinMarks.com. I could give you an equally long list of credits, probably even longer.
No problem.
But one of the early creators of the concept of podcasting, he was working at Apple, BBC before that, and he's worked also at Google, British Telecom. Now he's sitting in the rain in his garden. It's not raining
It's not raining yet.
It's raining here, so beware. Ah.
Isn't that good news?
Yay. Very
so it may
good
come
news.
This way, yeah. Okay. Well, I have umbrellas, so I should be all right.
No, it'll be fine. And if you have to move, we can make accommodations. Do you have a dog?
I have dogs. Oh. Dogs.
Does your dog bite?
Stop.
My dog. I want to get you out of here in time for the Republican debate on CNN, so that means we got about 80 minutes. I think that should be enough. I want to start with, we had a great conversation with Jenny Jardin on triangulation on Monday. Love her. Love Jenny.
She's so great.
Posted this morning on Boing Boing. Arab-looking man of Syrian descent found in garage building what looks like a bomb. Of course, Steve Jobs' biological parents were Syrian, or his dad anyway. And there he is building what looks like a bomb. I saw it in movies. I am so glad. This is one place where social media has such a great job to do. Of course, Anil Dash taking the lead on this.
Really taking the lead on Ahmed, and it's great. You've seen Obama's tweet, yes?
No, the president got involved. Good. President. What did he say?
Yeah, it's on the rundown.
Is it the POTUS account?
Yeah, and he tweeted, looks like a cool clock, and invited him to the White House.
Oh, I'm going to cry. Cool clock, Ahmed.
Isn't that the greatest?
Want to bring it to the White House? We should inspire more kids like you to like science.
Isn't that the best? on the rundown, I put in Ahmed's Twitter account.
Oh, good. And let me go there, too.
Near the bottom of other.
Okay.
It's nice time with Ahmed, yeah.
So here's a 14-year-old kid, freshman in high school, brand new school. He's kind of a maker. He's kind of a geek. He wanted to impress a little bit. So he, in 20 minutes, because he has a lot of stuff in his bedroom, a lot of electronic stuff because he's a maker. He built a clock. He thought, I'll bring a digital clock into school. That'll impress kids. Irving, Texas. Science teacher sees it and says, you know, I'd put that away. Do not show that to anybody else. Ahmed doesn't listen. He shows it to another teacher who immediately calls the principal. The principal calls the police. He's carted off in handcuffs, taken to a juvenile detention center. The police officer said, it looked like a bomb. Actually, he said it looked like a movie bomb. he was put in a cell, fortunately, this poor 14-year-old who just wanted to, by the way, wearing a NASA T-shirt with handcuffs on him in the picture that made it to the Dallas newspapers. He just wanted to show he was a geek with some cred. Instead, he's 3-day suspension. He could conceivably be prosecuted, although I did not listen to the press conference. Did the police department back down?
I didn't either. I don't know what the
stupid.
Well, it's beyond stupid.
It's racist.
Pants off. It's racist as hell.
It's horrific.
It's Islamophobia meets techno panic.
Yes.
And I wouldn't have led with it, except I just loved that picture that Jenny posted of a Syrian nerd in his garage.
Now this is the coolest kid in America.
Yeah, you know what? It actually was all worthwhile. I can't imagine how kind of scared he was when the police came and put him in handcuffs, because even though he told everybody in the school it's a clock, it's a digital clock, they said, oh, it's a bomb. The police described it as a hoax bomb, even though he's suspicious in nature. It's a clock.
Well, the thing is, you know, it's the kind of clock they put on bombs in movies for a plot point. You wouldn't actually put anything like that on a bomb. if you've got a bomb that's going to blow up at a certain time, you don't put a bright light on it that's counting down. That's just a plot device.
It's
exactly, you know, Bruce Schneier's movie plot threat nonsense personified.
Well, it also, to me, underscores how ignorant most Americans are about how electronics works. They've seen digital clocks. They just never bothered to look inside to see exactly the same kinds of components.
Right.
By the way, if it's a bomb, then where are the explosive elements of this? It's a circuit board.
That's a minor detail.
this will break your heart. The second tweet in this, which obviously I think Anil helped do. Ahmed says, thank you for your support. I really didn't think people would care about a Muslim boy.
Oh, I'm going to
Doesn't that
cry.
Just break it your heart? In this, and it breaks my view heart. Of this country right now. And I know people, your viewers get mad when I get to be political, but F it. I don't care. This is exactly why Donald Trump is a demagogue and an evil. We're trying to bring this hating of the others up. And this is the result.
It's Irving, Texas. The mayor of Irving is famous for being an Islamophobe. Look at all the great pictures in solidarity with Ahmed. I think so. This is where social media is just fantastic. This is all from his Twitter feed, which means he's seen every one of these. Grant Imahara, who is a wonderful fellow we know, makes stuff for the Mythbusters. Absolutely tragic. When I was his age, I took everything apart too and tried to make things. This is not what America needs. America needs people who make things, not terror and fear of a homemade clock and ignorance. I wonder if the Donald will mention this on the debate tonight.
Well, I would hope one of the journalists will. Hillary Clinton tweeted, assumptions and fear don't keep us safe. They hold us back. Ahmed, stay curious and keep building.
Yeah. I'm glad to see the this is a response and the support. He tweets, about to meet attorney. I imagine there'll be a bit of a lawsuit in that, which is a shame because really that's not the solution. The solution is this, which is so amazing.
No, but there needs to be consequences for bigotry.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Because what if this kid, you know, what if it hadn't come out on social media? What if there hadn't been an Anil, and this kid just ends up being miserable for years henceforward?
Well, and there are lots of kids probably in that position right now.
Exactly. For some slight that's not as so colossally theatrically stupid as this Texan moment.
It looked like a movie bomb.
Jesus. I saw some reference in the news that he was not going to be charged. No charges are being filed.
Yes, well, they dropped charges.
Well, yeah.
What would you charge him with? A movie bomb? There is no explosives. It's a circuit board and a clock.
You charge him with scaring stupid people.
Oh, you scared. You know, if that becomes a crime, we're in deep trouble.
Amen.
So they also questioned him without his parents' presence. So
which is awful.
There is going to be a significant lawsuit.
Oh, people should lose jobs, at least. People should lose jobs over this. Whoever arrested him, the principal of the school should be out of his or her job. The teacher who reported it, I would push for a 10-year fight on that. Yeah. The police who did this, the mayor, they should be hounded out of their jobs because who wants such idiots in charge of such important things as education and safety in this town?
It's not a bomb. It's a clock.
Jesus.
All right. I had to bring that up because
I'm glad you did.
For crying out loud. Google is, I hope I'm not stealing your number. I have a number if you don't.
No. I've got numbers. I did put this in the numbers, but I found it so fascinating. I saw that Jason put it up and I erased it from mine because it's an appropriate number.
2 billion lines of code run Google.
Wow.
Now, Kevin, you're a coder. Is that a lot?
Sounds like quite a lot to me, yes. I mean, you know, lines of code is always a silly metric.
Yes, I agree.
Yes. You know, it's just like, well, it depends how terse your language is. And it also encourages people to write ridiculous Perl scripts that fit on one line, which is not helpful.
Right. That's not good either. Microsoft Windows, they estimate in the realm of 50 million lines. This comes from Google's Rachel Potkin.
Now that surprises me.
I think that's a low number. I don't think that's accurate.
Really?
Low? Oh, yeah. Absolutely, that's low. Modern operating. I bet you... Chrome, I bet you Chrome is 50 million lines.
Really? I would think it'd be more efficient than that.
Well, lines doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
That's not an inefficiency, as Kevin's pointing out. Some of those lines are comments.
but Kevin's right there. We lost the scarcity of space with memory. I remember way back when I worked on the San Francisco Examiner, and we had SII terminals. They were smart terminals for publishing. And when somebody put hyphenation and justification and managed to fit it locally in the terminal. That was mind-boggling that was possible. Absolutely mind-boggling that could be done. And it could be done because there was such incredible efficiency in the code.
Chromium, which is the open source version of Google Chrome, of course we can count the lines in the open source project, is 17 million lines of code.
Okay.
That's for a browser alone. So 50, I think, is low for Windows. But in any event, 2 billion, I don't know, again, like Kevin says, doesn't really mean anything, but it's
yes, there's a certain amount of going on here.
Rachel Potvin mentioned this at an engineering conference in Silicon Valley. It's an estimate. That includes Google Search, Gmail, Google Maps. Again, it's a rough estimate, although I suppose you could count them. They're in a single code repository. That, to me, is more interesting. All 25,000 Google engineers have access to the Google code repository. She says, and I think this is probably the case, it's the largest single code repository anywhere in the world.
Wow. Okay.
That's a big deal, isn't it, Kevin, to put all of that code openly to it in a repository?
It's like one repository? That sounds a bit of an interesting
way. Well, if it's GitHub, GitHub has a copy of it everywhere that it sits. So.
Well, it's Git rather than GitHub, yeah.
Yeah, it's Git, right? Yeah. Not GitHub, Git.
I think it's Git now. It wasn't Git when I was there, but that may have changed.
I would bet they use. Do they use their own CV?
There was a mixture of things. There was some that was in Mercurial, and there was some that was in Perforce.
Oh, I'm sure it's all moved to Git by now.
They may well have moved it to Git by now. I don't know. And they've done a big project to move a lot of the external facing stuff to Git, certainly.
So did you? I mean, when you were there, could you access the repository?
Yeah, of course. That is true. The point is that everyone can see the code. You've still got to send pull requests to people if you want to change things, but there's a process of doing that.
I would hope so.
Well, there's a complicated process of different kinds of committers and who gets to commit things, and you have to have what they call readability in different languages.
Yep.
So that you have to, in order to submit changes to something in a certain language, you have to prove your competence in that language. And so there's a sort of a big peer process for this.
Oh, this is interesting. So the main Facebook app is 20 million lines of code, according to this article. And Facebook and Google are working on an open source version control system based on Mercurial. We're attempting to see if we can scale Mercurial to the size of the Google repository.
There you go. So, yeah, because they have been using Mercurial, which is the Python-based
Explain to people who are not programmers what a code repository is.
Well, the point of having a source code control system is that it doesn't just keep the current version of the code, and that's useful. It keeps all the previous versions as well, unless you see when they've been checked in and out. An analogy would be the edit history you see on Wikipedia. So you can go back to any previous version of the code. You can see who made the changes. You can selectively also create what are called branches. So you say, okay, I want to go off and try a side project here that doesn't go for everybody else's code. Work on that, and then when you're happy with it, bring it back in. So it's a model for doing lots and lots of edits on text in parallel, and making sure that you have all the versions of it. And this is obviously this is a core problem for programs. Before we had this, it was you were doing the same things people do with documents, where you save like version one, version two, and save copies and all that stuff. And if you know, it's also we get bits of this behind the scenes now. If you look at Google Docs or Words track changes and things like that, there is a sense that there are previous versions of the documents there. Apple has like previous versions of the documents.
Versioning is very handy, yeah.
But it's a hard problem. But a lot of computer science has been thrown at it, so we've got good ways of doing it now.
Everybody used Subversion. Linus Torvalds famously dissatisfied with Subversion with all the code repositories.
Well, there was CVS. There's a whole chain of different ones over the years.
Yep.
But the previous model was that you, the idea was you would have locks on each file in the repository. You check it out, and then when you had it checked out, nobody could modify it, and you would check it back in again. But that's how CVS worked. And Subversion was close to that. And the big change was... with Git particularly, and Mercurial as well does the same thing, was the notion that merging should be so straightforward you can have multiple versions. So the idea is that most of the time you check stuff out and have your own copies, and then you push stuff back in and it merges automatically. And it's only when there's a two of you have edited the same line or something that you'll get a merge conflict and you have to go and fix that. So the source code control is now designed to be done deeply in parallel. But there was still a cultural sense of there should be one true version, that you should get permission before checking things in and so on. And one of the things that GitHub changed was the institution of the first thing you do is fork the code and make your changes. And so both versions exist on the site. And then when you're done, you send a pull request to say, I've changed this. Here it is. You can go through and look at it. But in each case, you're working in public with all the variations on a theme. And that was an interesting cultural shift in the way that open source worked, because before that there was very much this culture of the benevolent dictator who decided whose code made it into the project, and done through main lists and so on, and that was why Linus built Git in the first place, was to help him manage that process. But in effect, the GitHub thing of making it all basically publishing your own fork by default does provide a different way of doing that. So you can, instead of saying, I'm going to go and argue with you about which version to go in the code, you can just say, here's my version, take your own pick. So you can be passive aggressive about it, or you can just put a version up there and then send a pull request saying, I've made these changes.
Right.
Tell me if you want or not. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think? But the point is, both versions are available and people can decide between them. So the sort of before this, forking a project was this like the only thing that only happens after a gigantic fight between the founders and usually causes all kinds of grief between the maintainers rather than the founders. Sorry. And now forking is the thing you do first before you do the changes. And then when you're all happy with what you've got, you send it back. So it's an interesting nuance in how the sociality of it changes by making more versions public.
Did you get to feed the cat, Jeff?
Yes, I did. Okay. I've been back, yes.
Jeff needed to feed his cat, so I asked Kevin.
You asked me something that would make me ramble on.
Something that would take a long time to answer. What is code versioning, Kevin? How does that work? Linesofcode.org. Code.org says there are people who've used Code.org, which is a great site for teaching kids and even some elders how to program. Lines of Code in the Code.org tutorial. 7.4 million people have written code on Code.org. I like that. Anyway, 2 billion. What I'm surprised at is that every engineer at Google has access. Isn't there a secret sauce, a Coca-Cola recipe in there somewhere?
Well, you know, not in a compact form like the Coca-Cola recipe. You know, it's the thing is that a lot of it is...
Wouldn't you worry about somebody just kind of copying it and going to Yahoo?
But the thing is, you can't, you know... Well, we had this conversation when we were open sourcing things when I was there. And the problem is, well, you can't really run this code without Google's infrastructure. You know,
it's not just the code, is it?
It's not written. Well, it's the code, but it's the way, you know, they've got all these systems that run on multiple computers in parallel, you know, MapReduce and all the other things that they've produced out there. And some of those have been released, but a lot of them haven't. And so there's this giant infrastructure that spins up machines on demand and spawns processes and makes stuff flow back and forth. And so there was, you know, at the time it was said, well, why don't you open source the search algorithm? It was like, well, the search algorithm isn't any use to you unless you all this other infrastructure and B, got a copy of the web on your servers.
Jeff, if you need to make a trip into New York to get something, just let me know and I'll ask him what MapReduce is. And actually, MapReduce is kind of magical, but I don't think we have time on this show. Let's talk about something.
I can give you a short version of it.
Okay, let's see. I'll start the timer. Kevin Marks, MapReduce, go.
So the basic idea of MapReduce is, instead of building a database to store things, you store the data in the original format and construct databases when you need them. And so the classical database model is you design the database, build indexes, and then you can ask it questions. But if you want to actually touch the whole database, it will be very slow because you have to go through a bunch of indexes. Yeah. Each read and write takes a lot of touching indexes and things because it's designed to be able to be flexible. And MapReduce sort of turns that around and says, okay, we want to go through this data set and make some sense of it. So we will read every entry in the data set once and perform the operation on that. And that's the map phase. Then you've got this giant intermediate product, which is basically that operation run on every entry in the database. And then you do what's called a shuffle, which is the bit that people don't talk about, which sorts them into some order. And then you do a reduced phase where you collate those back together. So if you're counting the number of words in a document, or the currency of a particular word in the document, you run a little program in the map phase that finds documents that have that word in. And then the shuffle phase, you organize them together. And then reduce phase, you go through and output all the documents that have that word in most frequently. And that's the count of how many times per document they occur. And that's your answer to the query.
It's kind of like a compression algorithm rhythm.
It's more a way of doing like... So it's a way of doing a large transformation on the data. And classically, this isn't something you do. Classically, with databases, you put data into databases and then ask the database about it. And the process of importing data into the database is something you do once, and it's this horrible code you write once, and everybody hates doing it. But once you've done that, then you've got an official way of updating the databases. And MapReduce sort of turns that backwards and says the script that translates the freeform data into the database is the bit that you spend the effort on, and the database is a disposable output of that because you can always run this thing again and adjust it. So it's
Google, did Google, I'm sure they didn't invent the concept, but they're quite famous for their MapReduce algorithm.
That was, I mean, I'm sure they completely invented the concept, but it was the thing that it sort of spawned the idea of big data. But I think that's a misnomer. It's more about messy data. The problem is the classic database thing is you're assuming the data, you're building a data model and organizing the world to fit that data model. And then the exercise is constructing the great data model and then working out how to get the data into it and then working what questions you ask of it. Whereas from Google's point of view, they were starting with the web, which is like the most giant collection of random bits of text in the world. Yeah. And so they were trying to construct meaning from that, which meant that they knew that the source of the data was always going to be messy and it was going to be growing all the time. So having a process for finding that order was the important part of it. And so they built this process. And, and at scale, the scale of it was hard too. But the scale isn't the key part of this process way of thinking, because computers get faster and get more capacity. It's more rethinking the way you're thinking about data in the first place to say, it's not a big data problem, it's a messy data problem. So what signal are we looking for this data? We'll run the MapReduce and extract that, see what we get, with the assumption you'll keep changing that MapReduce processing to do more things in future, and you get other versions of this database out. So it is a different worldview. And it's one of those things that's quite, this is part of the Google induction, is they explain all this process to you and how it works. And it is sort of, now there's third-party ways of doing this. There's Hadoop and other MapReduce-like processes and things like that as well. But it is a very much different way of thinking about things. And it was, for a while, that was very much Google's competitive advantage. It was not so much that they had, all these resources, but they had a way of approaching problems that other people hadn't thought of to use yet. And that, that has now trickled out, and there are other people who use that methodology. But it's a different way of thinking about data.
Moving on. I love this stuff. I've been having a hard time wrapping my head around MapReduce, so I'm glad you explained it so succinctly. Have you, Jeff, downloaded Apple's iOS 9 yet and taken a look at their new
what is it? No, I have not, because I've got to do it on my iPod.
Oh, God.
Or, I mean,
iPhone. That's a phone, I think.
No, it's not.
It's an iPod Touch.
iPod Touch.
Okay.
Yeah, so I have an iPod Touch that I use for running iOS as well.
God, that's sad. It's like, all right.
I don't want to buy another phone contract. So.
Right. Why not? So yeah, there's where I went wrong. I keep getting new phones. I should just stop and get some non-phone stuff. Of course, this is a new platform for news. Facebook's done it as well. Google and Twitter are now supposedly teaming up for instant articles. Are all these the same kind of thing?
I just did a column for this in the Observer, in New York's Observer. And yes, to the extent that they're radical distribution of content. The content's going to go to the people. The people aren't going to go to the content. Instant articles, we've talked about a lot on the show. Everybody knows what that is. This Google thing, which is still officially reportedly, but it's happening, is very, very interesting. And I'm going to make an analogy that's probably not technically true, but conceptually true. At I/O, Google showed custom Chrome tabs that allowed a developer to preload and preload a browser and prefetch content into it. So that when a user clicked on it, it would be boom, it'd be right there. So it's solving the same fundamental usability problem that Facebook is solving, which Facebook argues and Mark argues is speed. But Google is doing this as an open standard. And this is a discussion that I've had openly and here on the show when I got back from Newsgeist, the news Google confab last held in Helsinki. There was a lot of discussion of this because instant articles had just come out, and I was one of the ones in the room who said, "Okay, Google." Oops, sorry, I said that, folks.
Hey, Siri.
Your phones wake up.
Okay, Schmoogle. You've been one-upped. So, with the creation, now what are you going to do? And the thing I don't say they listened to me, I'm not saying it was probably already in the works forever, but I said, why don't you do an open source version of instant articles, that this kind of distributed structure I've been arguing for years. I think I wrote my first piece like 4 or 5 years ago, arguing that this is the ultimate extension of the link economy. That rather than forcing people to link to our sites and click to our sites, that we go to them, we embed our content wherever it is. That's in the Facebook flow. It's going to be on sites everywhere. So yes, the Apple News thing is one more piece of that, where you go to your audience where they are, whether that's in Snapchat, whether that's in Apple, whether that's on Facebook, whether that's on other sites. And I can see a world here where, you know, the Washington Post can do a deal with the New York Times and say, we'll prefetch all your stuff. You prefetch all of our stuff. And, you know, our own ads stay with our own content, our own.
And incidentally, ad blockers will stop working, right?
No.
Do you still have blockers work on this content?
I would bet it would.
That's part of the game of this.
Is that ad blockers won't or will work?
Part of what's going on
here. If it's a cached image of the page.
We're not sure. We're not sure how what's cached and what's going to be have to be fed live. Among the questions that have not been answered yet about this is exactly that question. So the content can be
everything will look like it'll be from first party if it's cached. But if the ads aren't cached, then that will be blockable.
And the reason they may not be able to be cached, I think, and this is just me speculating,
because you won't get metrics.
Well, no, you could still have a ping back. So here's to me the choice. And again, this is just me blathering here. I have no knowledge of this particularly. I see two choices. Right? One is to cache the ad, but then to write a ping back in this structure. So it'll ping back at the server and say that ad was seen. But what if this content was cached 2 weeks ago? And what if you have programmatic advertising, which is and retargeting advertising, which is trying to go to you exactly, but it can't because it just becomes a one-size-fits-all ad for everybody because it got cached into a page and you don't know who's going to call it up.
Right.
Now, if you do serve the ads live, the problem is you're back to square one in terms of the speed problem because that's what slows down all these damn pages. So I do not know what they're going to do about this.
So, you know, serving the ads live isn't intrinsically slowing the pages down. You know, Google serves the ads live, but they do it very well. It's more that... my sense is that we're in the stage that, you know, when the credit default swaps thing happened, it made money for a while, and then the margins were going down, so they doubled up on the kinds of credit default swaps they were doing until it got out of hand. And I sense we're in that phase with web advertising, where you used to be able to make money just by sticking AdSense in there, and now it's like, oh, that's not making enough money, let's stick something in there, let's stick this next thing in there. Which is how you get news websites where you open the page and it downloads several megabytes of JavaScript from a bunch of random sites you've never heard of before. And so, you know, Google's interest may well be to sort of strip those out and replace them with their own ads and say, look, we'll just put ours in because we know what we're doing. And there's obviously...
But the publishers won't allow that.
But the publishers may not allow that. But that's, but that's the question. I mean, do you remember Google Fast Flip?
No.
Oh, yeah.
What was that?
So Google Fast Flip was a previous attempt at this. Well, when was this? It was like 2009?
It sounds like a circus act. Something on AGT.
So basically what they did was they rendered the pages as bitmaps. So they would download load the web page in a browser on Linux and rip it to a bitmap and then serve you that instead. Because that was faster than rendering the HTML from all these sites.
Yeah, that's what this sounds like, but it's not.
I assume they're not doing that this time.
No, they're prefetching the whole page because the idea here is behind this, and this is what. And don't forget, this is around this digital news initiative, and so it's going to be try to be nice to publishers. It's not going to be offensive to publishers. That's the given of this. So the publishers say
it's gone now. It's gone in a big way.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. They didn't even bother with a fancy URL. Oh, that's because it's Google Labs, which is also gone.
It was
right?
A Google Labs thing, yeah. No, yeah. But this was one of the...
The publishers want their ads served on their pages. They want their analytics and their brand, and they want their look and feel.
Yeah, but we're entering a world of... today begins the ad blockalypse.
I agree, absolutely. I've been thinking about that. I've been trying to work on a post about this.
We should mention that's because iOS 9 comes out today. Apple will finally allow ad blocking in mobile Safari. There are already at least three different programs, including Crystal, that will do that, and I'm sure they'll be very popular on the App Store. The real problem with blocking ads, as soon as you do it, you never want to go back.
Yeah, and I wrote a piece for The Observer. I'm doing that weekly now on this and argued that I can argue, as we have on the show, we've had this discussion on the show, that you're stealing candy from the mouths of journalists by using ad blockers. But the truth is, we screwed it up. Advertising is so
awful. I think
awful,
they brought it on themselves. Exactly.
So slow.
Yeah.
They brought it on. So what we have to do, so you know, what I wrote about what I called an Imodium X-lax cycle here of blocking and unblocking. And
we've done this before. Remember pop-up blockers? Yeah. Pop-up ads got so annoying that every browser built in pop-up blockers. They all have them now. Nobody said that's the end of the web. But this is a little more global than that.
Right.
That blocked like just one form of annoying advertising. This blocks it all, including, in most cases, all analytics.
And the Washington Post.
Half the people are doing it because they don't want to see ads. The other half are doing it because they don't want to be tracked.
Well, that's because the apps are relying on tracking. I mean, that's the most annoying apps are the ones that stalk you around the web. So,
right.
You know, every time you touch a page,
people want to block the whole damn thing.
But on the other hand, Kevin, irrelevant advertising is also irritating. The problem is it's stupid relevant advertising, right? You know, the boots, you see the boots on Amazon, the boots follow you around long after you bought the friggin' boots.
Right.
Yes.
And so it's not just so much creepy as it is incredibly dumb. And so we've got to fix advertising at the essence. We've got to make it relevant and useful and informative and engaging again. The only way it can be relevant is if I know something about you. Well, that's the creepy line. That's privacy. We've got to figure out. I think we need to find a way to find a structure for consensual.
Neil I. Patel tweeted, "It's Apple's attempt to kill Google's revenue tonight."
It is.
He said,
it is. I absolutely agree.
Because Apple, by the way, will not block ads in mobile apps.
Right. Ads, Apple failed basically at the ad business. Right. Apple was supposed to become an ad giant. It never did. It failed. So it's gonna ruin it for everybody else. There's a moral hazard. The ad blockers on both sides have moral hazards, right? The ad block plus and all that has been called by many often, and I agree, racketeering, because they charge you for the whitelist.
Yes. And we do not recommend ad block plus. That's not our choice in any respect.
And then in this world, Apple has a moral.
It's also not very good code.
UBlock Origin is the one that we've talked about. We've Gibson did a whole thing on security now. Once you start using it, you will never stop. Everything loads fast. It's not even about not seeing ads for me. It's about how fast the pages load, how uncluttered they are.
Well, but that's what both Instant Articles and this new Google thing attempt to fix.
Right.
Right. Now, my friend Tantek runs his browser with JavaScript turned off by default so that everything loads quickly. Yeah. And it also helps him see which people are like not using the web because he's an HTML guy. But
it's hard to do that for very long. You run NoScript, and pretty soon you realize that you've turned off pretty much everything on the web.
Well, you can like turn little bits back on again.
Yeah, you have to. Otherwise, even our site won't work without JavaScript.
But so part of this is the ads things. One of the talks at XOXO this weekend was Heather Armstrong, Deuce, talking about how she gave up blogging because of the things she was expected to do for advertising now, because she used to be able to write what she wanted and fund it with the banner ads, but she had to, in order to make the money, she had to do what they call
native
content advertising.
It's a shame because Deuce's blog was one of the proto blogs, is one of the great blogs.
Yeah.
I didn't know she was going to have to give it up.
Well, she tells the whole story, and I won't, you know, the video will be up soon. I don't want to sort of take her punchlines away. But basically, she ended up saying that she was being forced to editorially compromise what she wanted to write by the people who were subsidizing it. She was being expected to, like, go and, you know, do things with her kids and take photographs of them using the products and all this stuff.
Mommy bloggers in particular are subject to a lot of that pressure. She couldn't resist the pressure, though?
Well, she did. That was the point. That's why she stopped.
That's too bad. But this is
uses Federated Media now to sell advertising on her site.
But Federated Media was part of the discussion. I don't want to, you know, reiterate her whole talk, but we do wait and see when that comes up. But the point is that it was very much this is sort of led to part of my sense that we have this problem where Maciej Czeglowski describes it as we don't really have advertising value, we have investor story time value, where you tell your investors that you're going to make lots of money from advertising in the future from this stuff. But in practice, it doesn't make that much because there is a gap between the, you know, because there is a saturation curve in what looks like an exponential curve. And we're sitting at that now with advertising. And that is the challenge. I think the challenge for, you know, my point of view on the challenge is we need to find other ways of paying for content than advertising.
I disagree. There isn't enough money, Kevin, to support what we need and have. And journalism won't be supported that way because journalism is information rich and information is immediately commodified as soon as it's known. So this idea that we should be paid for our content the way that HBO is paid for Game of Thrones, we're in completely different businesses and the models are completely different. And I don't agree that paying for content is going to work. The other problem with paying for content is it redlines journalism and redlines knowledge, and only those who can afford it get it. And democracy, that's big trouble.
But that's the point. That's why I'm saying we need to be paying for content, but not gatekeeping content. We need to reinvent the brought to you by viewers like you model of I am paying so other people can see this.
That's part of it, but we also have to. I don't think we can give up yet on advertising. Think that Apple's given up and Murdoch's given up, but the rest of us can't.
No, I'm not saying you can yet. I'm saying it's down to technologists like me to think about ways of doing this better.
But yes,
the thing is, at the point where advertising is paying you a thousandth of a cent per viewer, you're already in trouble, and that's why we end up with these sites that are full of several megs of different advertising, desperately trying to claw a few more micro cents out of each view.
That's why we have the 8,000 versions of the same story. There's 800 people who are going to the debate tonight, journalists, as if they're all going to have their own special, wonderful, unique perspective. No, they all want their own take, so they get their own ad on it, so they get their own pennies from that. And we don't reward original work. We don't reward real reporting. We reward an old business model, an old mass media business model of volume.
Yes, no, exactly. And so that's what I'm getting at. So the point is, if one person likes your thing enough to send you $10, that outweighs 100,000 ad views or more.
And so, yeah, and I'm not against that. I'm not all against that, but I'm just arguing. We've seen this argument for micropayments for Blendl.
What you end up getting is the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times. Yeah. And what you don't get is dues.
I think it's supplemental. I think it's supplemental, but it will not fundamentally pay what we need to pay for. The amount of ad revenue that's there, and again, a lot of it's inefficient and wasted and repetitive, and I've got other problems here. But I say job one is to fix and rethink advertising.
No, see, so, okay. Well, we can agree to disagree because I think job one is to replace advertising with something that doesn't have as many perverse incentives.
I think we're going to supplement advertising with those things, so we can agree to agree on that. But okay. I don't think.
What about Google Contributor? Is that a good middle ground?
That's my point. So how much Google should say? I'm going to bet you that the amount of money from Google Contributor is below de minimis.
Yeah, I would think that's probably true.
Well, sure, but it has the same micropayment problem. Whereas, you know, if you look at the money from Kickstarter, that can actually do these things because it encourages you to pay an actual sensible amount of money rather than a fraction of a cent that you have to track across all the sites you go to. So the question is, can we find a way to encourage that kind of model for news rather than just manufacturing things as well? So that's...
There are those who say advertising, advertising isn't free to you either. You pay for the advertising through paying higher prices for the advertiser.
Well, but in a competitive marketplace, you end up paying less.
I've had these conversations ad nauseum, and I'm sure those of our audience who watch all of our shows would yes. agree. But, we have a model. I know for a fact. Well, I don't know for a fact. But I have some evidence, considerable amount, that we could not do a paywall and still survive or twit. So advertising works well for us, but we have been very careful to respect our audience with the advertising that we do.
Sure.
I mean, Kevin, where we absolutely agree is I held an event at CUNY, my school, 2 weeks ago in membership. And I argue we've got to look at, right now in media, we see membership as another word for subscription. Give us money. We've got to see ways to serve new tribes. We've got to have new ways that people contribute to value to us besides just cash, which includes marketing and expertise and information. And we've got to give people new rewards besides just access to content, like social status and stuff.
What would you do if you were me? Just I'm curious, yeah. Either one of you. What financial model should I have going forward?
Well, that's the challenge. I mean, the challenge is... there's one thing. So one thing here is there is an inherent assumption in a lot of these arguments is that there is a single price. And this is a sort of shibboleth of economics, that there is a single price for things. And if you try and have differentiated prices, then that will fail for you. So you draw your price demand curve and you find the sweet spot between how many people pay us a dollar and how many people will pay us a hundredth of a cent or whatever. And the thing that I think is fascinating about the Kickstarter experience and Patreon and some of these other ones is that they're at, or you know, Humble Bundle, you know, there are several of these things, and what they say is, well, what is it worth to you? How much do you want to give? And this draws me back to the sort of the public media thing of what level are you contributing at? How much do you want to support us, and so on? And the point of that is, it's not so much you're setting variable prices; is you're giving people permission to pay a different amount and a reason to do so, and an emotional reason to do so. And I think understanding how that works is going to be interesting. And in a
we
sense,
do see that sort of, sometimes with the musicians and other artists, where they will say, pay what you think it's worth. And the experience of most musicians is that works very well. Yes. Who was it that did that with their, was it Nine Inch Nails? One of their albums.
Yeah, several of them did that. And Zoe Keating publishes her how much she gets paid on different systems and things, and talks about this a bit and says, yeah, there are people who will pay me $500 for an album. Because they like what I do.
Because they love you. Yes.
And Amanda Palmer has gone that way too, and I agree. But look at public media.
That's how they work, isn't it?
Not well, but advertising is absolutely vital to its survival.
Right.
They have huge ad sales.
more all the time.
less than 10% of the audience pays for the content.
I can no longer distinguish between whatever that is they call in public media and an ad. It sounds exactly like an ad.
Well, Leo, my advice to you is that you already have the model, and I don't like native advertising in when it tries to fool people, but advertising that is in the flow that you frankly can't get away from, that works and that's what you already have. So you're already way, way, way ahead of the advertising model.
Yeah, you know, Apple has introduced a new ad blocking feature, which nobody recognizes as an ad blocking feature, and it's Apple TV. Skip 7 minutes. They have a variable length skip built into Apple TV via voice. And that's...
I didn't know that one.
That is an ad blocker.
Remember when the DVRs were
set up to... Yeah, Replay TV got put out of business for that. They got sued to death. Yeah.
And the other thing that I think is possible, reprogram the button.
Yeah, TiVo hit it. They just had an Easter egg 30-second skip. Replay actually had a 30-second skip button. They're gone. And but Apple has enough market clout that they can do that.
Yes. Well, unless there are efforts. In fact, right now in Europe, Springer, who led the fight against Google, is also fighting against AdBlock, and they're going to court.
Good luck.
I don't think unblocking the blockers is going to win, but I don't think suing is going to win in the end, but I think we should, you know, trying it anyway is fine. I think Apple could be vulnerable here. I think that, you know, people go after Google all the time in antitrust. It's Apple that's operating to a moral hazard in these cases when it comes to the advertising business.
Yeah.
The other piece that you have, and I know you played with this in terms of, you've had contribute buttons, which are nice, and you're grateful to bring it in.
We started with that only. I said I won't do ads for the first couple of years.
Right.
Public broadcasting's model, I'm told, is that about 4% of the audience will contribute.
Between 4 and 9.
You have to harass them to death for that. I wasn't willing to do that. So we got about 1%. It was enough for me to do one, you know, to not to have an employee, or it was enough to.
But there's another question. I think that there's a kind of membership structure that could work for you. I mean, if you're a security geek, you want to support Steve Gibson.
You pay for Steve.
And
maybe you're not
paying for Steve's content. You are paying to support Steve's good work.
Right.
You're paying for him to be there. And again, you have to rethink.
So 80,000 people listen to that show for free.
Right. So that's a tribe. That's an extremely...
It'd probably go down to 10,000. How much should I charge? $5 a month?
You don't charge. Oh, you don't charge.
You don't charge. You
patronage. So the next questions are, how all do people give him value?
Right.
Right. And what privileges of membership do they get? At some level, there's a book called The Curve. And this is exactly Kevin's point a minute ago. There's a variable value here. We treat everybody in media all the same. When you go to the variable value, the author of The Curve, I didn't read it. I just listened to his lecture online for free. But he said you need a long tail to convert a certain number to pay a certain amount, but you then can convert some number of schmucks to pay $1,000 for fake hay to feed to fake cows. There are people out there, and Amanda Palmer, if you haven't, I think you've all watched Amanda Palmer's amazing TED talk about this. There are people who would pay $1,000 to support Steve, who would go to an event with Steve and pay for that privilege to be with Steve, or to be able to get a little bit of consulting from Steve at a certain rate. There is a variable value that you could capture. Less so for a show like this, because, Jarvis Blather is screwed. Not even worth that. Free is too expensive. But Steve has incredible value to people. People want to support his work. They believe his work is important in the entire ecosystem. Yeah, I think you could have the Steve Club, but it's not about charging for access to the show. Instead, it's about giving people... Have you watched the Amanda Palmer TED Talk?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's about giving people the opportunity to be generous to you. And right now, they don't have the opportunity. They have a give button, or they listen to the ads. That's really all you have. If you think through a membership strategy more... It goes around different ways to contribute and different ways to get rewards. Social status. If Steve mentions, here's my 10 biggest patrons. Thank you very much. And these 10 people, they'll quell the happiness that Steve has done this.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, a new Google project you're going to be excited about, Jeff, called Project Aura. But first, a word from our sponsors. All those words you love to hear. But first, a word from our sponsors. Actually, Samsung SmartThings is a sponsor that started with crowdsourcing. The SmartThings Hub was originally a Kickstarter project, and they did great because they were trying to solve a problem anybody who's tried to solve the home automation conundrum wants to solve, which is how do you get a bunch of different things using different protocols, different apps on the smartphone to talk to one another, to work together? How do you simplify that? The SmartThings Hub, that's how. So the SmartThings Hub talks to everything, hundreds of devices, including SmartThings' own devices, allows you to use a single app on your iPhone, your Android phone, or your Windows phone for monitoring, for security, for lighting, for entertainment. One app does it all and can combine actions from a variety of unrelated devices. So everything works together. I really like that. The new SmartThings Hub just came out. I think you're going to like it. Phones, light bulbs, everything, even your appliances can now be controlled from the SmartThings, the Samsung SmartThings Hub. Different actions when you're asleep, awake, when you arrive home, when you leave home. Get an alert on your smartphone if water is detected where it doesn't belong. No contracts, no monthly fees, and installation is a snap. There's nothing to do but plug it in. SmartThings, it's the easiest way to protect your home. And we're going to get you a deal on any of the featured SmartThings kit. There's the energy savings kit. That, by the way, they're fully extensible. You're basically just getting the hub and a few devices, the starting point, but you can add all sorts of devices. One hub can handle, I don't know what the limit is, but hundreds of different devices. Get 10% off any kit and free shipping in the U.S. Go to smartthings.com/twig and use the offer code TWIG. Take a look at the kits. And get 10% off smartthings.com/twig. Make your home a more intelligent place with SmartThings from Samsung. Samsung SmartThings. Smartthings.com/twig. Use the offer code TWIG. We're so glad to have their support for our show. And that is one thing that does happen is you have I don't think that's such a bad thing as you have a relationship with these companies to support the show. We were at last week. The reason I was in New York, Jeff, was for the IAB, the Interactive Advertising Bureau's first podcast upfronts. And that was very interesting. You know about the regular network upfronts.
Yeah, I wish I'd been there to go to it.
I'm sure you've gone to a few when you were a TV critic.
Oh, yeah.
So they'd bring in all the stars, and they'd show the new shows, and then they'd say to the advertisers, would you like to buy this brand new show for the upcoming year? That's not exactly how the... podcast upfronts worked. None of the podcast stars were there. There weren't that many.
You were there.
Well, I was there, but I, you know, I've been, I don't know if I'm a podcast star, but I am very committed to the medium that, so I wanted to support it. And, there were some big advertisers, some big agencies. But you know, podcasts don't sell a year's worth of, we don't announce the new season. There is no season. There's barely a season in TV.
Upfronts are about a scarcity. You want to beat somebody else to it and get the price before it becomes big. And so you're, it's like an airline buying gas when the price is down.
Well, the star of the show, of course, is Serial. Yes. Sarah Koenig was not there, of course, nor was the guy in prison. But I was stunned. Serial has set a new bar for podcast listenership. 12 episodes, 100 million downloads. That's counted by Podtracker that does our metrics. And I know Podtrack's very conservative. If they say 100 million, it's at least 100 million uniques. That's pretty amazing.
The Gimlet guys were at XOXO as well.
Yes.
And they were, you know, talking about this to some extent. And they're basically saying, we have very, very good ad rates. This is good, but it makes us a little nervous because we're not sure that's going to last.
Right.
They want to keep doing what they're doing.
Well, we're all nervous.
And,
I mean,
and they've made some very successful podcasts there.
Sure have.
Between Startup and
Startup and is the podcast about starting Gimlet. Yes. Anyway, it was fun. It was good. But there's still some nervousness.
Lisa sell any ads?
We sell ads. We have several brokers that sell ads, including Podtrack.
Was it worthwhile for business to go there?
Oh, it wasn't for us. We were there as guests of Podtrack, so Lisa was very polite and did not pitch any of the advertisers there.
Well, or Lisa!
She was very polite. But, you know, that was a big deal, and I was glad to go there to kind of support it. One of the things I told people is that we turned down a lot of advertisers because what we're doing is, and you should understand this, the reason podcast ads work is we're introducing our community, our precious community, to an advertiser.
Talk about that for a second, because I think that's critical to that. That's the scarcity we have to create in advertising, right? Is the idea that says that if advertisers want to be next to you create the flow, which is native, like old radio, number one. Number two, you create relevance because you want to think things that are going to be relevant to us as an audience. But number three, the thing that you don't talk about much is this idea of something passing to your standards. And not anybody can buy onto Twit.
In fact, there was an audible gasp when I said we turn down advertisers every day. There was and at first I thought, oh God, have I made some horrible blunder? but everybody said, no, it's okay. But they were shocked because that's not how it works. Nobody turns away money.
But that's so you're protecting. So nobody resents. I don't think people resent the ads that you have on these shows. We recognize what it is, and because you do that. Give us some examples. I don't mean specific companies, but the kinds of things you turn down.
Well, when we get inquiries from, sometimes I would turn down advertisers because to protect them, they want to spend money. And one of the first things I say is, you know what? We're not going to do any. We're not going to work for you because for a variety of reasons. I'll turn down a product that I don't like. You know, a lot of antivirus companies want to advertise. Well, we don't have any antivirus companies advertising because it's my opinion you no longer need an antivirus. Mm-hmm. So that's the kinds of things. Sometimes companies, once you don't have the conversation before the buy about what they want to tell the audience. I wish you could.
Yeah,
because sometimes after a company makes a buy, they say, now we want to say this. And then I have to go back, I have to push back and say, you're not.
Well, you do with an RFP.
Like Deuce does. Well, we don't do an RFP. But like Deuce does, where she says, no, I'm not going to do that. So, right. But we try to pick advertisers that would understand that before, you know, up front.
Yeah.
Like, you get this. This is not, we're not going to lie to the audience. We're not going to misrepresent your product. We're not going to tell them a need exists where it doesn't. And so we're pretty careful about who we pick. And I thought that was the message, actually. The main reason I went to New York is to tell these big agencies and advertisers that your idea of what advertising is has to change in the new world. Because
so talk about that.
You have to treat the audience with respect. Mm-hmm. And one of the whole reason for ad blockers is a lack of respect for people's bandwidth, time, and attention. You know, we say you're coming to our audience. We want you to come as a peer. Talk about features and benefits, hat in hand, saying, would you like to buy our product? Here's what it does. And we protect, I'm protective of the community because that's our real asset and that's all I care about. That's why we do it in the first place. And so the advertiser we do because we need to pay for all this fancy equipment. But so the it's a beneficial relationship as long as the advertiser understands that they have to respect the community as much as we do. It doesn't always, you know, it doesn't always work. A lot of people are very offended when I say, like, you can't buy ads. Like, what's wrong with us? And we try not to say, well, I just think your company sucks.
Do you lose agencies that represent those clients?
Oh, yeah.
As a result?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes we'll turn down, we'll turn away agencies. A lot of advertisers go through agencies still. That's a big problem with podcasting because agencies want to spend millions. They make money.
They're lazy.
Well, they make money on commission. So they get a percentage of the amount of ads they place.
And they want one-stop shopping at huge right. audiences so rather than well-known.
So they would much prefer to buy the Super Bowl than a podcast.
Yes.
Even though a Super Bowl ad at millions of dollars probably, you know, you spend $2 million on a Super Bowl ad, you could buy a podcast for the next 10 years. But Lisa says, stop talking. I haven't said anything bad. I haven't said anything bad. So, an agency prefers to buy a big thing like that, right? Because an agency gets a commission, and it's a lot easier to get a commission.
Speaking of a moral hazard, the agency is not motivated to save you money in your buy. The agency gets a cut of what's sold, and so the agency is motivated to make you spend more.
Yeah, there's that. That occurs in a lot of places in the world, doesn't it? The doctor who prescribes you medicines that you don't really need. I mean, I can go on and on and on that one.
Now this is when Lisa tells you to shut up.
Yeah, she's saying shut up. Been pretty much saying this for the last 10 minutes. I don't mind. I think I like to be transparent. I think that's part of the deal.
I think it's part of the value that you bring is that people can't be here unless you – that's the scarcity. Trust is the scarcity.
Now, Tuck says you only choose U.S.-based stuff. I don't choose the advertisers. Don't think that we're choosing the advertisers. We try to go out and sell, but we do turn away advertisers. And if we can't get – we have mostly U.S.-based advertisers or many U.S.-based advertisers, but that's – we're a U.S.-based company. That's kind of just the way it kind of is. Yeah. I would love to have –
very hard to do international.
That's hard to do. You know, and that's another case of where it's just – there's never been a market for that. When Ford buys an ad on NBC, they don't care if people see it in Germany. They're going to have to start, aren't they?
Yeah.
But they certainly don't pay for it at this point, right? Project Aura. Google has hired, you know, those guys who were working at Amazon doing the Fire Phone, and then Amazon went, never mind. First they canceled the Fire Phone, then they filed Lab 2126, which I'm told were very smart people. Well, they're now working for Google. Project Aura, A-U-R-A. It apparently just started in June. It's focused on reviving your favorite, Jeff, Google Glass.
Oh, sigh.
Yeah, Google Glass. At least three employees, according to Business Insider, from Lab 126 work in the new group. And they have a dedicated recruiter doing more hiring. What would be the next generation?
Something simpler that does one function.
Yeah. I feel like wearables are... I still believe in wearables, but I've yet to see one that I really like.
So Howard Stern is going to there. He refuses to wear the Apple Watch because he doesn't want an electronic thing on his wrist all day, on his body.
Is he afraid it may give him cancer?
Yeah, so have we ever heard of wrist cancer? I don't. Maybe there is. I don't want to make fun.
As far as I know, the real danger was when we had radium on the dials and the women who had to lick... The brushes to apply radium to the glowing watch faces, they didn't do so well. But I don't, you know, I think that the dangers of electronics next to your body are a little overblown. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. Okay. Howard Stern's a little bit of a weirdo. He's not Howie.
Mandel weird.
Mandel weird, but he's you know, I could see Howard wearing rubber gloves and fist bumping people.
Yeah, well, Robin and Howard were having a fight last week about who's more insane.
Yeah, I think Howard. That's but I don't know Robin.
Robin
that well.
Robin's gone and had ayahuasca and decided to do odd cults and things.
Okay,
now she's freezing herself. She's in that hyper cold thing.
Was she doing that?
Yeah.
Whatever.
But when she dies, or just generally?
Yeah.
No. as a live person, this is the new thing. You don't. It's, you know what, you're in air. You're not immersed in this stuff.
Right.
I thought you were getting in a tub at 165 below, but no, you're just in a. It's just chilly.
Just in a slightly colder room. Okay.
It's just chilly because air doesn't conduct, as you know. Air does not conduct all that well. I wouldn't do it in water or some liquid.
It would
burn you. You'd frostbite. Whatever happened to Google Books? Big article by Tim Wu in The New Yorker last week.
I thought it was a good article.
I thought it was a great. I like Tim Wu. He's
Tim
a guy.
Wu who just went to the Attorney General's office in the state of New York.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
He was a professor at Columbia, right?
Yes.
What's he going to do with the Attorney General's office?
Cyber stuff. So, and I like Tim too, but Tim's been a little
weird.
Retrograde in some ways.
He wrote the Kill Switch.
He wrote the Kill Switch, yes.
And he writes for The New Yorker, and he's talking about this project that is kind of sadly moribund to digitize all the world's books. And, of course, it's the Authors Guild and its ilk that shut it down, saying, hey, well, we want some royalties for those books nobody wants. How do you feel? You're an author. Where do you come down on this? I would guess that you're pro Google Books.
But, I'm very pro Google Books because I think that you know, listen, I've written three. People still do buy what would Google do, you know, and I'll get an occasional thing. But at some point, you know, let it be found. And the problem with this is that the promise of Google Books was all these out of print things that you can't get even on a Strand bookstore shelf suddenly could be exposed to the air again and people could read it again. But nope, that stopped. And I think that it was copyright fundamentalism to some extent.
Yeah, like Ursula K. Le Guin, who said the deal that the publishers did with Google was a deal with the devil.
Well, it's difficult because anything you say about it applies in the same way to libraries as well. So it's very hard to work out what the model
Larry
is.
Larry Lessig had a great solution. He said it's very simple. When a copyright is about to expire, you publish it and you say it, and you can renew it for $1. And if there's anybody willing to pay, if any author is willing to pay $1 to retain their copyright, then you renew it. Otherwise, it goes into the public domain and Google can scan
that
it.
Works, that also works if you reduce the copyright term back to a sensible amount. I mean,
right.
Yes.
The problem is that the way copyright is at the moment, but things never get out of copyright.
No, because we keep extending it, so Mickey Mouse is never available.
Right.
Enters the public domain.
So there's a challenge there. But the other half of this is, you know, how do libraries work? And the Internet Archive has done a bunch of work with this as well, because they scan physical books too, and they're trying to work out, okay, yeah,
Brewster
can we...
Kahle says, just damn the copyright law and full speed ahead.
No, he doesn't. No. He's trying to work out how to be an actual library because that's what he cares about being. He wants to preserve things.
Right. So what makes it a library versus Google Books?
You can check out books from the library, but you have to check them back in again. So there's a certain weirdness about that. So there's a notion they've only got one copy of the book.
They've tried to do that with audiobooks and things that are digital, it's just strange.
It does end up being sort of completely
insane.
Obviously odd and wrong. Yes.
You check out a digital copy of a book, and then you have to bring it back after 2 weeks.
Yes. It's like, hmm.
So they did make a deal in 2008, but four years ago, a federal judge threw out the deal.
Right.
Saying that the copyright issue should be decided by, this'll work. Congress.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that'll work. Of course, leaving things to Congress, Tim writes, has become a synonym for doing nothing. And predictably, a full 7 years after that court decision, we're still waiting. Meanwhile, Google has stopped scanning.
I don't know. Depends on what they're scanning. Yeah. I don't know.
You know,
I
mean, maybe they should just keep scanning it.
I mean, it's at some level for them, it's data.
Yeah.
And they love data.
Their idea was to make the world's information available to everybody, available and searchable.
Organized and accessible.
And that's exactly what this is, especially books that are obscure, out of print, not out of copyright, thanks to our ridiculous copyright law.
Yes.
But still of societal interest, but not of any financial interest to any author.
Right.
Apparently, the Authors Guild has proposed a solution called extended collective licensing that would allow the owners of scanned out-of-print libraries like Google or actual nonprofits to make a limited set of them available with payouts. The U.S. Copyright Office supports this plan. This sounds a little bit like what this kind of weird hybrid thing that libraries are doing today. Tim says, I suggest something simpler, the Big Bang license. Congress should allow anyone with a scanned library like Google to pay a price, say $125 million, to gain a license subject to any opt-outs, allowing them to make those scanned prints available to institutional or individual subscribers. That money would be divided equally among all rights holders who come forward to claim it in a three-year window, split 50-50 between authors and publishers. Yeah. Why would Google do that? That's basically saying...
Well, the point is that Google would... You'd have to get legislative backing for that. It would be a compulsory license like they have right. for cover versions of songs or something like that.
Right.
You have to actually pass a law. So that is the challenge of that.
Nobody's going to pass a law.
No.
We do have some good news about the dancing...
President Lessig, maybe.
Lessig. President Lessig. You know, I think maybe the fact that all of these candidates are just eating themselves alive might... Maybe just one. Maybe it's that like some sort of annealing process where all of this junk gets burnt off, and then all that's left is Larry, and he becomes president,
and then he quits.
He has a very good. That was his plan. I'm going to have a really good vice president.
That was actually the Howard Stern plan for governor.
Really?
Yeah, back when.
In the dancing baby case, which was a sad, sad case. A 2007 YouTube video of a toddler dancing happened to be a Prince song playing in the background. Prince sued. It's all the way up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals now. And actually, this isn't really about that dancing baby video. The kid, by the way, is now like 10.
I wanted to see if there was some follow-up to the kid.
Yeah.
This kid should have gone to the Supreme Court just for the fun of it to say.
I agree. Yeah. But more importantly, the justices ruled, and we're going to talk about this on Saturday with Denise Howell, our tame lawyer on the new screensavers. The justices ruled, this is the big thing, copyright holders like Prince must consider the existence of fair use before sending a takedown.
Yes.
Yay.
Wow.
Which is a good precedent. On the other hand, they also said... But automated programs could be part of this too, which is like, that's the big problem, is that automated programs cannot distinguish fair use. You know,
right.
if we can't even get expensive lawyers to distinguish it without actually litigating, it's very hard for a program to do that. And that is part of the challenge of it.
This is a huge change because all up to now, and I've always was told this, fair use was a defense.
As Larry Lessig has always said, fair use is the right to hire a lawyer.
Yeah. So in other words, after you get sued, you can now use it as a defense in court at a great expense. But right. This court is now saying, no, before the takedown, the copyright holder should consider in her head, is this a fair use of my copyright?
And if that person, if that copyright holder does not and goes after again and again and again, I presume that gives us some recourse that if they take down Twitch shows again and again and again, at some point, you can maybe have some basis to say that they were negligent in their obligation to fair use.
I think we've been whitelisted because we did for a long time get tagged on YouTube all the time. And to my knowledge, that stopped, right?
Knock wood.
And of course, it was Content ID, so it was automated, as you say. And so the point is that an automated system could be, with some human intervention, used in a way to protect fair use. You could say, no, that's a news organization. So when you try to do a takedown,
it was costing them money with staff to review all these cases. And,
right.
And at some point, they just say enough.
Whitelist it. Say, you know what? Twit's going to do this all the time.
Yeah.
People are going to complain all the time. But Twit is a news organization. And traditionally, news organizations are allowed to use small bits of copyrighted material as part of a news story. Anyway, we'll watch and see, and we'll talk more about this with Denise. She's an attorney.
And the Sarah Young's article at Mother Jones was a good summary of it.
Good. I will pull that up. Good news, anyway. I think.
I think it's a recognition that there's something else going on, but the algorithms bit is a little bit tricky because as Sarah points out, you know, there are four tests for fair use, and one is how much of the thing do you use, and that's
right.
The only thing algorithms can measure. and they're only approximating it.
Well, I'll give you an example. You could whitelist us.
You get lots of weird takedown things.
Yeah, I mean, if I started using a Prince song as a show open, that would not be fair use.
Right.
And so you could whitelist us, but that doesn't mean that everything we do with stuff is fair use. It doesn't. Not everything passes those four tests.
Right.
Hey, if you need a lawyer, you need LegalZoom. Well, I should be very clear about this. Legal. Is it now native content if I didn't, like, say, and now a word from our sponsor?
Your voice changes.
Ladies and gentlemen.
People know.
I think people know when I'm doing an ad. Yeah. LegalZoom's not a law firm, but LegalZoom is great if you need to do legal work like trademark, copyright, last wills, living trusts, form a business, an LLC or a S-Corp. LegalZoom is awesome. Most of that stuff is just paperwork. You don't need to spend hundreds of dollars an hour talking to an attorney. You can do it all yourself on LegalZoom.com. And they're very transparent. You know exactly how much it's going to cost up front. They're fantastic for the basic stuff. Now, occasionally you do have a question, and that's where LegalZoom has a brand new thing that I love, the LegalZoom Legal Plan. They can connect you with an independent attorney at a flat rate, pre-negotiated flat rate. And you know what's nice is they have profiles of the attorney, but even reviews, customer reviews, so you can really see what you're getting. LegalZoom is not a law firm, and they have to, by law, they have to say that. But that's why they give you such great value. They don't charge you by the hour. Instead, you get transparent pricing. You get customer reviews, so you know what you're getting up front. I think we should just have customer reviews for the legal business in general, don't you? That'd fix a lot of things. If you do need legal advice, their network of independent attorneys can provide the straightforward guidance you need in most states. There is, leasing your house, you go to LegalZoom. You know, LegalZoom is awesome. LegalZoom.com. Don't let legal hurdles become an excuse. Protect yourself, protect your family. Do it right with LegalZoom.com. And don't forget to use the word TWIG, T-W-I-G, in the referral box at checkout, and you'll save $10. And they'll know you heard about it on this fine show, and that's important, too. LegalZoom.com.
All right, I got a question.
Okay.
I just updated the iPod.
Yeah.
It took a while. It took the entire show.
Yeah.
I'm looking for Apple News. Where do I get it?
Go to your home. It should be on there.
Really?
Go home. It'll be probably on the front page.
It's right next to the
newsstand.
They've taken newsstand off. You shouldn't see newsstand.
I see newsstand with a little tiny...
Make sure you got iOS 9.
Oh, no.
Maybe you got 8.4.1. maybe you haven't been updating religiously. Shouldn't see newsstand.
General about... Where do I find... A 9. Version 9.
Well, why is he seeing number newsstand,
nine.
Folks?
Right. Number 9.
You don't see an icon that says news?
There it is,
news.
I found it. I found it. Good. Icons, stupid things, icons.
They may have to update apps as well. He's getting going.
Yeah, well, I think you get that. I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I haven't done it yet. Tell us what you think. A first look at the new news, Apple News.
Waiting for it to do anything, but...
Well, there you go. That'll speed.
Welcome to news. Round, round, and round, and round it goes.
Well, this was my comment on the Facebook 8 seconds thing as well. They say, when you click a link in Facebook, it takes 8 seconds to launch the web. It's like, well, when I click a link to Facebook from the web, it takes 8 seconds to launch Facebook. You know, it's like, which side of this line am I on?
When you spend the next hour there, Kevin, you're not launching anything else.
Well, you're building your news sources now, Jeff. This is a one-time only.
Oh, yeah. I've heard that story before.
Yeah. I guess newsstand, I'm being told by the chat room, is still there as a folder. So you can open the folder and the magazines that used to be in your newsstand will be in there as standard.
You can put it in that folder. You put things like an uninstall folder somewhere you've hidden on
the junk folder. Every iPhone has it. Every iPhone. I don't use Apple Weather, Apple Stocks, Apple Tips. But you can't delete them. Google has invested in Oscar.
Yeah, it's only in New Jersey and New York, and it's a new insurance company. I'm not exactly sure. I'm just going to remember now.
I think they were an advertiser. Didn't Oscar advertise with us? I think they did. Yeah. So they are kind of a high-tech health insurance company. This is one where I was reluctant to take them as an advertiser because it is only New York and New Jersey, but I thought what they were doing was so cool.
It really is. It starts with technology. Tell us your symptoms to get started. You can shop for a doctor, pick one you like.
Exactly.
Just click to talk with a doctor right away.
I really liked this idea. They said we're going to be going into other states too. So I thought, well, let's do the ads, even though, I mean, talk about U.S. only ads. This was a New Jersey only ad. But that's another case where sometimes an advertiser will just, I want to do their ads because I think what they're doing is really interesting. And now I think that's validated by Google, which has put $32.5 million in Oscar. They're now valued.
With Misfit. And when you hit your daily goal, you got to buck off up to $240 a year.
Nice. Isn't that good? So it kind of incents you to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're $1.75 billion valuation. So they're a unicorn. And they want to make the health insurance business work more like an internet service.
It's not available in my area.
Yeah, that's kind of part of the
problem. I'm in New Jersey.
Well, Don't know. They're focused on individuals, not groups. Anyway, I really like them. Anyway, good on them. Google's really gotten involved in the medical area, hasn't it? Those contact lenses that detect for diabetics that detect.
Well, the other fascinating story today is they hired the top mental health official in the U.S.
Yeah. A mental health moonshot. Boy, I'm behind this. Dr. Tom Insel, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, for the last 13 years, he's joining Life Sciences. That's the two-year-old research division that, among others, was spun out when Google became Alphabet. And they're working on mental health. Here's his statement on the NIM website. That the Life Sciences team at Google would establish a major exploration into mental health is by itself a significant statement, recognizing the burden of illness from psychosis, mood disorders, and autism, as well as the opportunity for technology to make a major impact to change the world for the millions affected. I'm so thrilled to see this. This is great.
Yeah.
Mental health treatment in the United States is barely medieval.
Amen, brother.
As some of you know, as I know firsthand, and it's not about better drugs. It's just about destigmatizing it, doing the research, doing the hard work. But I'm glad Google's putting some money behind it. That's great. Really great.
All right, I'm picking sources now.
Oh, good. What are your choices?
Get news in your inbox. No. Don't do that to me. they were there. The New York Times, The Guardian.
How about tech sources? Were there like tech blogs?
Recode.
Yeah, it's going to be all the big names.
So then, all right. So the first one. Oh, you see, this is not. It looks like Kanye West watched a lot of Star Wars while designing his latest collection.
Okay, that's one I don't want.
No, Apple. That's your first story you give me.
Can you minus that? Can you use the new Facebook dislike button?
Which way do I go? Left or right?
I thought that would set him off. I was hoping that would set him off. Oh, can you use the new Facebook dislike button?
There is no dislike button. All my colleagues in the news business got it wrong. Just listen to Zuckerberg. He didn't say it was, he said dislike, but he said it wasn't a vote down button.
It's an empathy button.
An empathy button. I'm not going to like the fact that your mother died. I'm going to give you empathy for that.
So we were getting all excited in the news business because the idea was kind of like Reddit style upvoting and downvoting, right? Wouldn't that be cool? No. And I'm sure Facebook would like to do that, right?
No, they don't want to do that.
Why not?
Zuckerberg said in his town hall, that's not the kind of community we want to build. You shared something, you put yourself out, you share something in the world, then everybody comes along and says,
well, that's true, I guess.
That. Nobody in the world wants that. We don't need more of that in the world. I agree with Zuck on this.
Yeah.
Yes.
But we have that on Google Plus. Oh, no, there's no minus one, is there? It's only plus one on Google Plus. But what the problem is, I'm really devastated. My mom just died. And then what am I supposed to do? Like it? No.
Yeah.
So empathy would be like, what's it going to be like? Oh, it's going to be like a little
Mark Zuckerberg.
Button.
So I learned this from courts just now, and Mark Zuckerberg invited Ahmed to Facebook.
Yes.
The poor Ahmed's never going to get to go to school anymore. He's going to the White House. He's going to Facebook.
He's busy, yeah.
MIT invited him.
he's going to have to do the Ahmed World Tour.
Well, Gabe Rivera said, can you come over here and tell us why WatchOS 2 wasn't released?
There was a press conference while we've been on the air that I just saw the lower third said that he might consider transferring schools.
yeah, I would at this point. I don't think you'd want to walk that walk of shame.
I don't. What's so special about Apple News? So it's a bunch of stories, most of which aren't relevant to me, from sources I already have, with no
ads.
Okay, fine, big deal. And no way to say, no, I really don't like that. You're wrong. Because that's the Apple attitude. No, you're wrong about us being wrong.
So you can't downvote that Kanye?
No, that's the first thing. I know I'm shrieking right now. The New Yorker. Zuckerberg, how about an oof button?
Oof. Oof. Or what would be a good Yiddish...
Oi.
Oi would be good. I'd like an oi button. Oi. That says a lot. We need meh.
And
we
if
need
you hold it oi. Down, it turns into oi gewalt. You know, it's like
oi gewalt.
It gets bigger. The thing that's the interesting sort of variant on this is the thing that Slack did with the emoji. I don't know how much you guys use Slack. You've seen this. They invented reaction emoji. So when someone posts something, you can react by posting an emoji. And other people can click on that to increment that emoji. So,
oh wow! So the reaction goes up.
So the count goes up for the number of people who've clicked that one. So you can use it to put two like alternatives in as, you know, do you want, you know, burger or fried egg, and put the emoji in like that. But anyone can react with an emoji, and then other people can sort of pile on that emoji. So it was their way of saying, okay. I suspect it was their way of getting around the whole. Do we do likes with hearts or stars argument by saying, well, why not all possible combinations of strange characters? So you can react to things by sending people goats or 100 underlined or whatever other emoji you like best.
Meh. By the way, here's the iCloud news publisher at iCloud.com/news publisher. If you're a publisher, can we get on this right away? You can enter your publisher information and add your RSS feed to Apple News.
But you have to run it through an Apple-shaped validator, so it's like the podcasting one with some extra nonsense on it.
Oh, we can handle that.
Yeah,
they did. They made a totally unique RSS format for iTunes podcasts, which, by the way, we still adhere to. And interestingly enough, I can't talk about it. I'm non-disclosed. Never mind.
Yeah, I know. You were looking for permission to say something.
Well, it's not even that I'm non-disclosed, but the people who are non-disclosed mentioned this to me, and now I don't want to get them in trouble. It has to do with Google, but I'll save it for later. I don't know. Is it official yet or not? I don't know. Patent for giving up or regaining control of self-driving car. I think you need a meh button. Google self-driving car patent reveals how you'll let AI take the wheel. It's called Google Chauffeur. And there's an arm on the steering wheel, kind of like your turn signal, that could be pulled to engage the self-driving mode. At that point, the system checks to see whether it's ready and able to actually take control from the driver. If it can't get a GPS lock or something, the driver could see not available on the dash. Otherwise, you'll see a ready light, at which point you could start taking your hands off the wheel and your feet off the pedals and start texting, apparently, according to this patent, at 64 miles an hour using an iPhone. Anyway, just because they have a patent doesn't mean they know how to do it. If the passenger identifies an emergency situation, the passenger may take control of the vehicle immediately. If you see an obstacle the computer hasn't identified, like a bicyclist or road construction, you don't even disarm the computer. You just grip the wheel just like cruise control. And this is just like cruise control. There's no news here. It's just like cruise control. And of course, Google.
I say about Apple News, meh.
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 Meh. Meh. Supposedly Android Pay has rolled out. I'm sure you talked about this yesterday on All About Android. Did you have you got it yet, Jason?
I had to install it.
How old? Oh, you have to get it.
I had to go out of my way to install the update. So basically, it's kind of confusing.
I'm sorry, I interrupted your lunch.
It's okay.
So I apologize.
Okay. I was at the end of the bite.
Android. So it's called Android Wallet?
Android Pay.
Android Pay.
Yeah, so the old Google Wallet app is magically turning into Android Pay.
Right.
And then they pushed out a new Google Wallet app to the Play Store to be your transferring money between people app.
So it says I have Google Wallet installed, as I would expect.
But it also relies on a current version of Play Services, which this, might not be updated.
It says this app will update to Android Pay soon.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, this is it a staged rollout? There, you got it? Look at that.
Yeah.
Look at that.
There we go. Now, did you get it automatically?
Yeah, like, I didn't do anything.
Okay.
Well, let me look at mine.
I had to install it manually in order to get it, and I haven't really played around with it very much yet.
Did you install it with a side load?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's not how you're supposed to do it.
Yeah.
Coming soon, Android Pay and a new Google Wallet in the next few weeks. Wallet will turn into two simpler apps. It's the first time I've ever heard. Wallet's most popular features will move to two simpler apps.
Okay.
I don't know what's simpler about that.
Do you guys either really use NFC Pay?
I used it for the I've used it on the watch just because I wanted to play with the watch.
Yeah, I know, playing with it, but do you really use it?
I used it yesterday at the Monday at the ball game.
Oh,
but it's kind of just like it's not that.
Use it occasionally, but the thing is,
occasionally, it's not that much easier.
Well, the thing is, since they launched Apple Pay, it's got more annoying because there are people who are turning it off selectively. You know,
right?
Before you would see a little sign say, "Okay, I can use this," and they'd sometimes be surprised it would work. Whereas now they have the terminal that says you can use it, and then you can't because it's like, "Oh, no, this is CVS; you can't actually use it." And I did use it the other day because I'd accidentally left my wallet at home. And so
it's
I was
handy
able to
for
buy
that.
Something with it. It's handy for that. But
yeah,
it's not. It's not. It's sufficiently quicker. Is the thing.
Yes. Well, so I use it at the ballpark. I tap it. The guy says, "No, wait a minute." And then the thing says, "Wait a minute." Then he says, "Okay, now do it." And I did it. And then I still have to sign something, which is
weird. Oh, no, you're kidding me.
Yeah, you still have to go through the flow, basically.
So it's really no different than if I'd taken a credit card out and swiped it. I mean, it's
I do use the Starbucks thing every day.
Yeah. But you have a special card for that, right?
Yeah. So if it's under the thing where the credit card don't have to sign, then it is a bit quicker. But if it's over, then you've still got to sign something.
Yeah, this was a...
And you also confuse the checkout person as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He says, "What does it say on your screen?" I said, "It says stop." Okay. Russia says, "Google bad."
Yeah, like I'm going to trust Russia.
Russia, you know what? To their credit, we did this fast. Everybody else is still thinking.
Well, yes, this is what happens when you have a dictatorship. You can cut through a little bureaucracy.
Google found guilty of abusing dominant market position in Russia. Russian antitrust agency. It's funny they have an antitrust agency.
Yeah. You are not owned by us. You are antitrust.
What does it even mean to be antitrust in a socialist republic? Russia's antitrust agency will have 10 business days to issue its ruling on the case in full. They opened the probe in February, so 7 months later. That's not too bad. Company was not found guilty of unfair competition. But they were found guilty of abusing their dominant market position. Of course, the action was prompted by Russia's search engine, Yandex. They complained. Yandex said, quote, "We welcome the positive decision by FAS, which has figured out this complicated case, and having studied the proof, has confirmed Google's violations."
Does it, do you think this has any potential influence over what the EU is like, just from a,
they won't be alone. They won't have to worry about being the only ones.
Right.
But I don't, I can't imagine they care. Let's see. Just looking, we're down to the C's and the stems. Almost done here. Google says it's not going to make cars. It's going to license them.
Which does go to the European point, though, because as media went batty on Google in Europe, the auto industry was ready to go next.
Yeah,
they were scared. They're very scared of Google, and so Google coming out and saying
in Frankfurt,
speculation is
at the Frankfurt Auto Show in Germany.
We want to work with you.
Yeah,
it's you.
We do not intend to become a car manufacturer. This is coming from Philip Justice, a Google representative.
Yet they just hired the former president of Hyundai US.
Wow.
For Google Auto.
Well, that makes sense because if you're going to deal with automakers, you would like to have somebody inside who is an automaker to talk the talk.
Yes. He's a respected guy.
Yeah.
And it shows they're serious. It shows they're very, very serious.
Have you turned on your OnHub?
Jake did today.
Yes.
And he said that the speed is about the same across the house. The only thing it'll improve is that closet behind me over there.
Yes.
That's not my dog, it says. That closet I'm pointing to right now, that has the router in it.
You put your router in a closet.
Well, yeah.
No, you're supposed to put it right in the middle of the living room.
But that's where the wire is.
Oh.
And so the problem is that it would improve the speed, he said, in this room, but I'm the only one who gets benefit out of it.
Yeah, right.
And so I don't know if we bought two of them. Would that be okay? Do I really want to spend $400 right now? I don't know.
By the way, this just in, Ahmed has been invited to Twitter. Should I invite him? Let me just tweet. Ahmed, you got a job here. You could build clocks for us.
Because we're never on time.
You're never on time. We could use your clock. Actually, that would be
Need your clocks, Ahmed.
That'd be a good tweet.
Go ahead, do it. Let's see somebody making something back. Neil may come back.
That'd be funny. Hey, Ahmed. Hey, for all I know, he's a big fan. I don't know.
They don't know.
He's a geek. He's
geeky enough.
So there's a teardown at iFixit of the OnHub router.
Yeah.
Speaker's bigger than it needs to be. It only is used once to pair to the phone, right?
I thought we had said that it was only a small speaker, but no.
But according to iFixit, it's not as big as the Sonos, but it's pretty hefty. That's weird. It's not an Echo. The odd little plug in the speaker grill is an ambient light sensor, which Google says doesn't work yet. In fact, there's a lot of stuff in this which doesn't work yet. Including Zigbee, radios and Thread radios. There's a Bluetooth radio. Doesn't work yet. It's all sorts of stuff. I don't know if you care. I canceled my order. And just got a kind of more common Asus router, which I've been very happy with. Let's see, what else? I got a fix for the final stage fright flaw on my AT&T Note 5 and on my Nexus 7 tablet. Have you gotten a fix yet, Jason? This phone has not gotten a fix.
I got a security update on my Nexus 5.
That's it.
My 6.
I did on my Nexus 6 too.
So that's Google's
first monthly security update.
Oh, this is going to be a regular thing.
You're seeing, yeah.
Because I got all these updates, and I was like, am I getting 6? I didn't think I was getting 6 yet. And then
You're getting your monthly update. Get used to it.
It didn't even change the number. It was still 511.
Interesting. Yeah, but look at the build. That's where they changed the little subtle numbers down there.
I actually want a release note for that because that process is very slow. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to sit here and patch 200 apps in front of
you. It is. Yeah, if you've got a lot of apps installed, it takes a while. Lately, it takes a good 20 minutes.
Lately, that's what everybody, Apple, Microsoft, they're all just cagey about what's going on. So this is the Moto X Pure. It has not been updated yet. And
If you, by the way, the stage fright detector to get is the Zimperium one. They're the ones who discovered the flaw, Zimperium. And you see, it's this one little red one there. That's the last one to get fixed. But it has been fixed now on Nexus devices. It's been fixed on the Note, oddly enough. Samsung fixed it, but not yet on the Moto X.
By the way, I have seen tweets. I haven't verified what's going on, but apparently the new Moto phones,
yeah,
unlocked, you know, by yourself, people, yeah, aren't being able to put them on Verizon.
Oh no!
Yeah,
are you kidding me?
I haven't verified. I don't know what's going on, but I got some tweets.
Jeff Bezos finally doing something with the Washington Post. He's going to give you a discount if you have a Prime account.
It's a heck of a discount.
La presse papier sera remplacée par la presse. What? Somebody gave me a French article?
Oh, that's because La Presse in Montreal, did I put that up, is going to one day a week print. They've been very, very big. They made everything for the iPad. They went crazy on the iPad. Spent a fortune, like $20 million.
And stopped printing?
Brilliant job. And now they're going to kill all days except Saturday.
They're going to stop printing.
It's an important moment in newspaper.
Stop La Presses.
Pas de la presse.
Pas de la presse.
I don't know what
that is. What is the discount? So that's bad link.
On Bezos?
Yeah.
It's going to be like $46 a year. It's nothing.
Whoa! You know,
I pay $600, $700 for New York Times. The Wall Street Journal is like $900.
Yeah.
So the Washington Post is going to be – the Washington Post, I was hitting the wall fairly often because I was reading stuff on the Post. You know, you have two stories left. Do you sure want to read this?
I know. You actually have to do that calculus. Well, maybe there'll be a more important story tomorrow. I don't want to use up my five stories.
Did somebody else write this story, in which case I go elsewhere? But the Post had an amazing story this week on the disappearing American love for the pawpaw fruit. Now, that's the kind of story that doesn't get rewritten everywhere. It was a great story. Did you know about the pawpaw fruit?
I never even heard of the pawpaw.
Is Elgin around? I'll bet Amir has cooked some.
He's not.
It's like a cross between a mango and a banana.
Oh, it looks good.
Big, yeah, doesn't it? Big fruit. It grows in 26 states.
But NPR had an article 3 years ago, Foraging for America's Forgotten Fruit.
Well, there you go. There's nothing new.
Nothing new under the sun. It's the largest edible fruit native to the U.S. You can go to pawpaw-fruit.com. I don't see the Wall Street Journal piece on this Google search.
No, it was the Washington Post.
Washington Post piece on this Google search.
That's weird. Go to the news tab.
More news. Here it is. Nope. The Courier Journal, September 8th. The Splendid Table, September 11th. You know what? They're just hopping on the pawpaw bandwagon.
Is that it?
Yeah. The Courier Journal did it a week ago. Oh, maybe this is... It's an edited excerpt from Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit.
Oh, it is.
It's from a book.
A book. Oh, God.
Oh, the paw.
So this guy's at Mount Vernon.
Yeah.
Believed that pawpaws were big in Jefferson. He asked, they said, no, we don't need pawpaw trees here. No, not at all. He goes walking around the grounds. He finds a pawpaw tree, and he says to the guys, you got one right here.
So George Washington and Thomas Jefferson loved them some pawpaw.
Yeah.
So where can I get a pawpaw?
I don't know. I'll just ask Google. Hey, Google, where can I get a pawpaw?
So do you eat it like a mango? Do you eat out the middle or?
Yeah, I think you spoon it out. I don't know. Are there pawpaw recipes? I don't know.
No, I'm sure there are.
I'm telling you, Elgin's going to be in. Elgin's
already. Oh, yeah, he's all over it.
Pawpaw pies.
He's all over it. He's got a pawpaw orchard, probably. It grows wild in 26 states, sustained Native Americans, European explorers, presidents, and enslaved African Americans, requires no pesticides or herbicides to thrive, and contains powerful anti-cancer agents. I want me a pawpaw tree.
Kentucky State University has a site, pawpaw.kysu.edu.
Wow.
The Pawpaw Program.
According to Droid Life, the Moto X will work with Verizon by the end of the week. Verizon says we just have to get the IMEIs in the system. End of the week, Jeff.
End of the week. Yeah, I heard that's right before.
I'm not saying get it, but end of the week.
Oh, we missed the Paw Paw Festival.
Oh, man. So
this month in Ohio.
Can I get the Washington Post delivered here in California?
No, no, no. You don't get it in print. You get the digital.
Oh, for $46 a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get the digital version.
But you don't have to do, you know, it was thrown in with the fire, I think, before. You don't have to do that. So if you're a Prime subscriber, it
costs that's you. A penalty. Wait, no. I have to have a fire too?
No, you don't. No.
You're a Prime subscriber.
Oh, man.
They send you a fire.
I don't want a fire. They probably have a few left around. All right, let's wrap this thing up. I got a number for you, Jeff.
You do?
Yeah, and I'll talk about the Moto X Pure because that'll be my pick of the week. I'm sure, Kevin, you can come up with something having to do with the indie web.
I will take that challenge.
All right.
Uh-oh. So one of Jeff's numbers is one of that I can ramble about.
You can take one of them. Take your choice.
All right. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. Oh, I love FreshBooks. It saved my life when I was a freelancer. If you're a freelancer or a small business, and you know how painful it is the end of the month when you've got to send out the invoices. Oy. Well, let me ask you a question. Which of the following tasks represent your favorite part of being a freelancer? A, formatting and sending invoices. B, collecting your receipts and tracking your expenses. C, following up with clients who don't pay you on time. D, none of the above at all, anytime, ever in a million years. That's probably the answer you give, certainly the answer I give. FreshBooks changes all that. It makes it easy and fast to send out invoices that get paid faster because there's a pay button right on the invoice, and your clients don't like paying any more than you like. You know, I mean, it's a pain for them to sit down and write all those checks. Make it easy for them. You get paid on average 5 days faster. And if clients don't pay you on time, FreshBooks automatically will send out emails reminding them in a nice, subtle, but effective way. Even if you're not a numbers person, you'll love FreshBooks. You'll be creating and sending invoices in seconds, watching expenses organize themselves. In fact, the FreshBooks app lets you take pictures of receipts, add them right into the invoice. Oh, man, I wish they'd had that when I was billing Rogers. I used FreshBooks, but this is something more recent. It's really great. But they always had a great team of support folks at the FreshBooks headquarters. They still do. Award-winning support rock stars waiting to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. There they are. Aren't they cute? FreshBooks.com. Saved my life, and they got me paid a lot faster. They could do the same for you. Try it free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twig, and when they ask you, how did you hear about us, don't forget to say, twig, this week in Google. That's where freshbooks.com/twig. Real quick note, you know there are fires going on up north of us in Lake County. One of the places that burned to the ground is a little museum of telephony, the JKL Museum of Telephony, lost to fire on September 10th in Mountain Ranch, California. It was just kind of a labor of love.
Well, that's sad.
Isn't that John K. LaRue, whose initials just happen to be the number 5 on most telephone dials, JKL? They had telephones and related equipment from all over the world going from the 1880s to present day. They were working on getting many of these working. Look at the Pac Bell exhibit and these ancient phones. And oh, it makes me sad. All lost to fire. But they want to rebuild it. And I'm really thrilled. And they say, we don't know how, but I think if you visit the site, JKLmuseum.com, and you can just give them some love and support anyway. And they still have a huge website with photo galleries of all sorts of stuff. So big that you could help them get it to load faster. They'd probably appreciate that. Look at those. Remember those, Jeff?
Yep.
Oh, man.
Yeah, none of you kids remember those. We used to have to dial our finger around.
Dial.
Wait for it.
You never wanted a number with a zero in it because it's like 30 seconds. It felt like to go all the way around. Look at those.
The wrong number was painful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you should try texting with these phones. It's murder. So I just thought I'd pass along.
Jason, are you young enough you never saw a dial phone?
Oh, no,
not true. I used to have one. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. My kids, though, and I'm sure Jake in their 20s, I don't think they've.
Oh, no.
But they still talk about dialing a phone, I think.
And hanging it up, which is ridiculous.
Hanging it up. There's nothing to hang up.
With one of those, if you hung it up really hard, you'd hear the ring. That was like satisfying.
Right. Ding.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm slamming this phone down. And you get a little ring out of it. Kevin, I think you might be muted, by the way.
Muted. Sorry, there was a plane going over.
Ah. Right. This is so sad. This really looked like a neat museum. Lots of people losing their homes in those fires. We have some stuff we'd probably be willing to donate. Jammer B donated this to us back in the early days of the Twit Cottage. Hello, Central. That is classic. Where did you get that, John? And then this one we found somewhere like in an antique store around here. This one hangs on the wall. This is your kitchen phone. Hello. Man, I bet the sound. This is Western Electric before they invented Bakelite. That's solid metal. Wow. Mr. Kevin Marks, you got a tip?
A few things. So one of Jeff's numbers was the Google logo in 305 bytes.
I thought you'd like that.
Oh, that's a really interesting one. We haven't really talked about that yet. The original Google logo was how big? 14K?
Right.
The image. And the new one?
Yes.
305 bytes.
Well, so the thing is, the point is that it's easy to draw an SVG. So I got the G down to tweet length just by playing.
Serifs are hard.
Well, they're not that hard because, you know, you'd actually do have cap. So there's, I just put the SVG for the G into the chat. So serifs are, serifs are a little harder, but it's more that the oblate shapes, you need to use Bezier curves and that takes a bit more stuff, but you can still do a pretty good vector version of it. It's just not terrible. And someone else did a full version of the Google logo as an SVG that was fairly small. So the guy who does it here, he's doing it wrong. He's basically saying, oh, I can construct it out of chopping slice out of a circle, which you can, but actually SVG has a path operator, which is, so in my one says, go to the middle, draw a horizontal line, draw three quarters of a circle, that's the G, then draw two more circles. So basically you can do it in a bunch of paths. So you've got a graphics language that can draw straight lines and curves, and complicated curves too with SVG. So part of this for me is like, the thing that's exciting about this, because there's, I don't want to go around the Google logo nonsense again, but the SVG is actually really interesting. SVG is a vector format for images, which... we've had vector formats for images for a long time.
If you've used Illustrator freehand, that's a vector drawing program.
Or if you've used like Pict on the Mac, I'm talking a really long time.
Yeah, that's right.
Quick Draw.
Mac Pict. Yeah.
So Mac Draw rather than Mac Paint.
Mac Draw.
Going back to
the
Mac Draw was the file format. Pict was a file format for Mac Draw when it became
popular. So Mac Paint was a bitmap. You draw dot, dot, dot. But Mac Draw, you draw circles.
Yes.
And it's easy to represent those because those are mathematical formulae.
Right. So SVG is scalable vector graphics. It's a part of the web standard. Oh, it's a series of web standards. It's basically an XML format for drawing vectors. And it's really nice because you can draw vectors that are very small. And the other thing that's really nice about it is now that we've got all these very high DPI screens, you don't have to store a giant bitmap to show something that's crisp. You can just draw a curve. And so the Google logo thing was a bit weird to me because they were saying, oh, the serifs, they take up too much space. It's like,
those are just curves too, right?
And we can make it look better on small screens. It's like, no, they've just drawn it this way to be fashionable. And yes, you can make it very small in SVG, which is kind of cute. But you could make the original Google logo fairly small in SVG as well because you're just drawing, swirly shapes. So, and they will still look crisp at any size. And if you've got a 4X like 400 and something DPI screen like this, they'll look lovely on here as well. and you won't have to store a series of bitmaps. And one of the things that's annoying about this is that lots of the operating systems and websites that we use all the time are behind in their support of SVG. So if you're building iOS apps, they insist on you making bitmaps for them for lots of things. You have to have a bitmap for the splash screen, and you have to make one at different sizes for all the different iOS devices and so on. You can't upload an SVG to Twitter or Facebook or Pinterest or, you know, Google Plus even. So this is frustrating. So what I did, as a sort of tongue-in-cheek joke, I did svgur.com, which is like Imgur but for SVGs. But because the point of it is like you should be able to hand these things around. They take almost no storage. You can actually sort of paste them into tweets and still have something useful. So this was a little, you know, prank thing that I did, a semi-joke thing I did a while ago.
What is this site? SVGur. Is like SVG. Imgur for SVG?
Yeah, Imgur for SVG. So this is a site that I hacked together a while ago because I wanted to pass SVGs around. And you'll notice that most of them are like me playing around with Google logos and other little bits and pieces, IndieWeb logos. But the interesting thing is that they are really small and compact, and it's a very useful way to represent things. So if you're doing web design, you should be using SVGs. And they can animate too. You can see the rotating surface.
And all browsers render them properly and everything?
Most browsers render them properly. I mean, it's now at the point where all the browsers you care about render them properly, unless you're really unfortunate and you have colleagues who are running IE8 or something.
Yeah.
But they passed over the install base of Flash about 3 years ago. And if you look at caniuse.com for SVG now, it is like in the 90s of install bases, and it's all the mobile ones. And that's where you really care about this, because right. The mobile ones is where you tend to have the multiple DPI issues.
And so, it wouldn't be such a big deal to test the platform if it can't play SVGs to offer something else. But
yeah, no. So I mean, I
prefer
do
SVGs.
I do a fallback thing with this for Twitter and Facebook. I give them a Twitter card that has a ping in it, so that they can display something. But
right.
But the point is that if you're actually designing for the web these days. And you're doing things that would represent well as vector graphics. Obviously, it doesn't work for, you know, sunsets and things. But if you're doing things that are actually icons and logos and graphs and anything that is composed of lines, you're far better off using SVGs than anything else. And the other neat trick is that you can inline them into HTML fairly straightforwardly. I mean, you can inline images into HTML by putting data URLs, but SVG, you can just put the SVG in line, which means
because it's just text.
Yeah.
And you can animate them too, which is interesting.
Animating them is a little tricksy. There's different ways you can do that. But yeah, they have an intrinsic animation model. There's a little bit less support for that. Then you can also animate them with CS animations in the same way you can animate
sure.
HTML with CS animations.
Anything, any image. So what do you use to create these?
You can use Illustrator. You can make them by hand. Or you can, if you want a free thing, there's Inkscape. Which is a open source app. I mean, it runs in X Window, so it's a little bit weird, but it's a fairly good SVG editor.
So I'm going to add this to my 25 line email signature, a little animated SVG. I think that
they may not display an email. That's the thing, because email use this sort of weird, broken, old versions of HTML.
Look, here's the Singapore rail map in SVG.
Yeah,
that's nice.
That was an interesting one, because the problem is there they didn't do the text as text, so each character in there is an individual individual line, which is not ideal. So Somebody was posting this and saying we need to clean this up.
We need to fix that one. So where can I see what the code looks like for the?
Don't do it on that one. But if you do it on like the Google logo there,
yeah,
just do view source. Right click and do view source.
Okay.
Or inspect element maybe.
Where's the code? I don't see it.
Oh, it's embedded as an image, so hang on.
Never mind. That's all right. I believe you.
I mean, I can...
What does it kind of look like?
It looks like XML.
Okay. Wow. Really? Wow, that's really cool. Svgur. That's a good tool, S-V-G-U-R. You don't mind if people use it?
I don't mind if people use it. I mean, you know, don't destroy it, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, sure.
Here's a fun little article somebody just sent us from 2011. Turns out in the Steve Jobs biography,
when Steve Wozniak was in 12th grade, I remember reading this now, he built a fake bomb. He took a metronome, realized it sounded the tick, 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 sounded like a bomb, so he took the label off some big batteries, taped them together with duct tape, put it in the school locker, rigged it to start ticking faster when the locker opened. That's Woz. Not just happy with a tick, tick, tick. Later, he got called to the principal's office. He thought it was because he had won, yet again, the school's top math prize. Instead, he was confronted by police. The principal had been summoned when the device was found, bravely ran onto the football field, clutching it to his chest, and pulled the wires off. Woz tried and failed to suppress his laughter. He got sent. He went to the juvenile detention center, spent a night there. But, of course, what did Steve Wozniak do in juvenile detention center? He taught the other inmates how to disconnect wires from the lamps, attach them to the bars so people got shocked when they touched them. Now, that... I don't know what that means, but Ahmed, you are not alone. But he was trying to make a fake bomb. Ahmed was just making a clock. Jeff Jarvis, your number.
So we have from Business Insider. Jonah Peretti, founder of BuzzFeed, has some surprising numbers on the traffic that BuzzFeed gets from various sources. Now, keep in mind that traffic to BuzzFeed's site isn't always the point of BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed is really good about putting stuff everywhere. BuzzFeed's built for this distributed world we discussed earlier. Nonetheless,
interesting. But how do they make money if they do that?
Because they're basically what they do is they sell their skill to advertisers that we can make your stuff viral too.
Oh, okay. So it's not about the ads on BuzzFeed.
No. It's when they make stuff, it's that they want people to share it, and it's through that sharing that they create their value.
Neat.
So they're built for a new world. So 21% of its traffic comes from Snapchat content views.
What?
21% joined Snapchat's Discover in late July. It's already that big. The other numbers that it said here, 23% direct to the site or apps, 14% YouTube views, 2% Google search to the site. Because what are you really searching for on BuzzFeed besides cute cats?
Right.
6% Facebook traffic to the site. But again, keep in mind, that's not necessarily the goal. 27% Facebook native video, which is huge for them.
Wow.
4% images on Facebook and 21% Snapchat content views. I don't know if that adds up to 100% or not. But I found that really interesting. And you know, the thing that fascinates me about Snapchat is that I know lots of really, really savvy social media people. We run a degree in social journalism. I know lots of them. Anybody over the age of about 25 is like a 60-year-old and says,
"What is this? Why do you kids love this
Snapchat? I don't get it. I can't figure it out." It's phenomenal how there's an age barrier there, and Snapchat's huge.
You may say they don't make any money on ads, but the very first thing is a Pizza Hut ad.
Oh,
and by the way, one of the things about Snapchat. Wait a minute, it's not an ad.
At supper time.
Well, it is, but it's
got other pizzas. I never use these emojis, so I'm just going to try them out here. Huh? Newborn puppies ready to take on the world. See, the thing, I think Discover makes sense for quick hits. So, like, I always thought ESPN sports highlights in Discover, which is one of the things, makes a lot of sense. I think that's an anti-smoking ad. Maybe not.
No labeling, though, right?
No, I guess not, yeah. It's definitely anti-smoking. Oh, yeah, see, Truth? That is an ad. That's a paid ad. Conquering Home Luck, or maybe it's not paid. I don't know. Don't know what that is. Face aerobics. Now, if you slide up, you get more. Someday.
I want to be young forever.
You get the rest of it. So these are little snippets from the bigger viral video or whatever that they're... Where will I meet my true love? It's horoscope. Photo that will give you major bold lipstick goals. Not me. These are girls not to kiss.
Oh, go ahead. Let's try it.
No, these are the girls you don't want to kiss. You get all over you. And back to smoking. Oh, it says ad. There is a little tiny, almost invisible AD. You can't see it, but I can see it. Right at the lower right there. I guess teenagers like this.
Those kids.
Kids love this stuff. Ramen mozzarella sticks.
BuzzFeed Gigantic. Gigantic.
Yeah. I guess it's okay. Yeah, you're right, though. I think anybody over 25 goes, I mean, I know all
it's
about
not, it's
it.
Not just, it's not just not liking it. It's saying, I don't get it. It's a confessional moment.
Well, I get it.
For these folks is I can't figure out what to do with it. I can't figure out, you know, how to bring my company to it. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
How many of the things that you're going to say tonight are going
to
be...
Yeah, this is just, this is waiting in line entertainment. That's all this is. And this, I don't, what I don't like about Snapfeed, I'm trying to get back. Here we go.
Snapchat.
Snapchat is,
Grandpa.
What I don't like about the Snapfeed is that everything disappears. I know that's what the kids like, yeah. But I don't want to spend any time making content. There's a new feature, which I can't get to work on Android, but it works on the iPhone. If you're going to take a selfie and you press and hold your head, it will start doing weird animated stuff to your head.
Yes.
Have you tried that?
I have seen examples of that, but
yeah,
I haven't tried.
I can't get it to work on Android. It says only newer Android phones is as new as you can get, but it doesn't work. Well done, BuzzFeed. You figured it. You've cracked the internet. It's Snapchat.
Yep.
You know, Yahoo pulled it off. Remember Yahoo had a Katie Couric news update?
Yeah, I don't know why.
Maybe they weren't getting 21% content views from it. I wonder if that if the content view is when I does that count when I slide up? Is that a content view?
That's a good question too.
Content view to I can't because Snapchat doesn't really give you a way to link to a website, right?
No.
So they must say, what are they? What in fact? What are they saying?
What is there a BuzzFeed in that page? Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah. This is Discover on Snapchat. These are brands: TasteMade, IGN, Mashable, iHeartRadio. CNN. So you go to the brand and they make Snapchat specific content. So in the case of news, it just, and this just keeps repeating. Boy, this is news, isn't it? This is hardcore news. That's
this
it.
This is an ad for their news. Yes.
And then you swipe it and you get something else. Now see this, now it becomes more content because I swipe it up. And there's an actual story. I bet you that's what BuzzFeed counts as a driving traffic.
As a reference, right.
Because there's nothing else you can count. Yeah, it's aimed at the under 20 set. That's for sure. That's for dang sure. Baratunde uses it. Makes a Snapatunde every day. He's making Snapatunde. I got a number for you. You want to know my number?
Yeah.
Can you get a wide shot? This is my number. 5.4 pounds. That was this Sunday's New York Times. 5.4 pounds. That's not a record, I'm sure.
Oh, but, not from the old days, no. It's, but just it's people suddenly, it's the first time that you have any heft.
Look at the size of this thing.
It's all the arts and leisure preview stuff. So they got high-level advertising. From,
but you can't tell me they're not making money on the print, huh?
On that, they're making money, yeah. On that issue, they made money.
Yeah. 5.4 pounds. So I'll give you a quick summary on the Moto X Pure because I got it. First of all, I love Moto Maker. That's the feature that Moto X, Motorola gives you to build your own. Many, many different possibilities. Plastic, wood, and leather backs. I got the nice ebony back, which I think is quite pretty. I had bamboo 1 year. I had leather another year. And this champagne color. And so you can control a lot of this. You can even get your name on it, although it's not engraved. It's just kind of cheaply printed on there. The first Moto X back in 2013 was really the phone of the year for me. I was really impressed with what it could do. And each year they've come out with some new features. This is 5.7 inches, very high res UHD, or not UHD, quad HD screen. It's snappy. They only put 3 gigs of RAM in it. It's not a beast because it's cheap. It's about 400 bucks, depending on how much storage you have. You can either get 32 or 64 gigs of, or maybe 16, 32. No, I'll have to look it up. I got the 64 gigs, and I didn't really need to because the other thing that's cool about this is you can put a SD card in it, and this goes up to 128 gigs. So I have 128 gig SD card.
Is it any problem to move stuff back and forth?
It's a lot easier, much easier now on Lollipop than it was before, but generally you keep the apps on the internal storage And the external storage is for pictures, music, movies. I have all my audio books on here and stuff like that. It's very snappy. This is only a Qualcomm Snapdragon 808. It's not the latest, greatest. But that is probably not a bad thing. I don't think you need all that horsepower in the Note 5 and other devices. It's got the great Motorola stuff. So they've always been really good about this. It is an LCD screen, not an OLED. So when you hover your hand over it, it gives you the time and notifications. But because it's an LED, it has to turn on the whole screen, which the old OLEDs did not have to do. It also has the gestures. You know, you do this to take a picture, and it pretty quickly goes into the. It's hard to do it in this over my shoulder camera. Never mind. It never does that. Chop to turn on the flashlight. There you go. That one worked. There's also a way to get it to do a kind of a personal. Stop it. Thank you. A personal Google Now interaction by just lifting it to your ear. But you have to do this kind of thing. And I've never been able to get it to work quite right. There's some negatives, though. There's no fingerprint reader. There's no OIS. 21 megapixel camera means it's got great images. I'm going to do a full review on this, but I have to say battery life is a little disappointing. Once again, it's maybe 8 or 9 hours for me, which is not long enough. I wish it had a fingerprint reader. It needs OIS. The 21 megapixel camera is pretty good. I'll show you real quickly some photos from Google that I've taken. Some does well in broad daylight. But the neat thing about 21 megapixels is you can do digital zoom on. This is actually zoomed in, but you get pretty good resolution. You can also control the exposure with a slider. So you see, I dimmed it down until we could actually see the sunset. I took these of a tire swing, so that's not very interesting. It has a selfie flash, a front-facing flash. Does great in broad daylight. Here's some other zoomed shots. Let me show you real quickly an example. Sorry about all these. These are all panorama, you know. I don't know why. Okay, so this is heavily zoomed. I'll show you the original shot. Is here. I zoomed in with digital zoom, and because you have so many megapixels, this I find it interesting. You really can take advantage of the extra megapixels by getting a very high quality. You know, there's not a lot of artifacting in here. High quality shot, even zoomed in. So that's kind of nice. So it's a good camera in daylight, not so great in low light, especially without OIS. But I have to say, it's a nice camera. I mean, nice phone. I just don't think it's really up there with the top-of-the-line phones, unless you really want a wooden or leather back. I'm not crazy about... I feel like this would have been a great phone last year. And gosh darn it, they got to get the battery life better. You weren't considering this, were you, Jeff? This wasn't one of the phones you were thinking about.
Nope.
You are waiting to hear what happens September 29th, though, the Nexus 5, right?
Oh, yes, I am.
Well, we will cover that live. I understand it's going to be a streamed event, and we will be covering the live stream early in the morning, 10 a.m. for you, Jeff, 7 a.m. out here on the West Coast.
Where is it going to be?
Tuesday the 29th. I think it's in San Francisco. Do you know?
Oh. We don't know specific details yet.
Haven't been invited yet.
Yeah, there hasn't been a formal announcement of any sort, but yeah, the rumor is San Francisco somewhere.
If it's in New York, let me know.
Yeah, we will. I don't think it is because it's 7 a.m. I guess it could be. Yeah, 10 a.m. You know what? I bet it is in New York. You're right.
That's what I'm saying. You're right. If it is, I'll get an invite and I'll go.
Absolutely. Jeff Jarvis is at City University of New York, CUNY. He also blogs at buzzmachine.com, joins us every Wednesday for this fabulous show. Will you be here next week?
Yes, I will.
Nice.
Pretty sure.
Kevin Marks, always great to have you. Thank you for being here and explaining.
One more little link for you.
Yes.
This is Indie News, news.indiewebcount.com.
Ah.
Which we had it for a while, but it was quite hard to submit. It's just got easier to submit to. So you just have to link to it now and then send a web mention.
It is a community curated list of articles. So relevant. So it's kind of like Hacker News for the indie web.
Yes.
I love it, and I will absolutely subscribe.
There you go.
Just read it regularly.
And submit your articles to it if you've got indie web articles.
Nice. It's still a pretty small community, right? I mean, you know everybody who's in the indie web community.
To some extent, yeah, it's pretty much. What's changed it has been known, which means there are people using it that we don't necessarily
nice.
Know directly. But
good.
Yeah, it's a There's a few hundred of us in the IRC, and there's, well, 100 and something of us in the IRC, and there's others who come and go to the meetings. But yeah,
you absolutely. We all want to support the future of an independent web, and that's what IndieWeb is all about, and some really cool technologies to do that. Thank you, Kevin, for being here. That is news.indiewebcamp.com. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday afternoon, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern Time, 20:30 UTC. Tune in live if you can. Join us in the chat room if you can't. Man, it's okay. It's okay. I'll cut you some slack. Just download a copy. We've got it here at twit.tv/twig, but you'll also find it wherever podcasts are aggregated, so you can subscribe and listen every week. I hope you will. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.